So am I still waiting? Waiting a long time.
Waiting for tonight.
Listen to review,
right now, right? That's what you say. We get it by now.
I want you to digest this, because before I leave in 3 weeks with your WWE Championship, I have a lot of things I want to get off my chest. I don't hate you, John. I don't even dislike you. I do like you. I like you a hell of a lot more than I like most people in the back. I hate this idea that you're the best. Because you're not. I'm the best. I'm the best in the world. There's one thing you're better at than I am, and that's kissing Vince McMahon's ass. You're as good as kissing Vince's ass as Hulk Hogan was. I don't know if you're as good as Dwayne, though. He's a pretty good ass kisser. Always was and still is. Oops, I'm breaking the fourth wall. I am the best wrestler in the world. I've been the best ever since day one when I walked into this company, and I've been vilified and hated since that day because Paul Heyman saw something in me that nobody else wanted to admit. That's right, I'm a Paul Heyman guy. You know who else was a Paul Heyman guy? Brock Lesnar. And he split just like I'm splitting, but the biggest difference between me and Brock is I'm going to leave with the WWE Championship.
Just because the angle's a bit more natural.
Well, I can do this. Watch this way. I'm gonna be a professional. I can come over.
No. I don't want you.
No, because then this encourages you to talk more. And I notice when certain people are on the show.
One of these. I almost feel it'd be easier to just have something in front of me.
I kind
of
like this, though. I kind of like this relaxed pose that I'm doing.
Your spine is going to be... It gives me... I feel awkward for you.
You're staring into my belly button. It's like you're seeing my soul.
At least I can, project here. You can't really fit in there.
Yeah, but I notice, when certain guests are on, that Wei can lay in the cut and not talk at all, and then it just becomes the John and the guest show. And I've also noticed that sometimes you can lay in the cut, and it just becomes Wei in the guest show sometime. So this one, I've got my strategy.
Well, consider yourself honored, then, that... I'm not a fan of really the three people for that very reason. So it's only a few that I'm willing to do it for.
Oh my gosh!
You're one of the exclusives.
So much has happened in wrestling. The smells like Teen Spirit has happened.
Smells like Teen Spirit of pro wrestling.
There's already a backlash saying that it wasn't that great.
So
smells like Teen Spirit?
No.
Oh
no.
One,
Okada
2
versus Omega 2. But that's like the punk community not liking. It smells like Teen Spirit and Nevermind.
Yeah.
You know, the punk community never embraced it. They were like, oh, it sucks. You know, it's nowhere near as good as Bleach, if they liked it at all.
You're almost asking for this debate when people are saying this was the best match ever. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I was actually disappointed there wasn't much debate after this. I thought that's what's going to – I think for these matches now, you need that post-debate to kind of lift the match up so it's remembered more.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't really sense any of that. Like, there's been very few that have been – have said anything bad about the match or contradicting it. Most are in agreement. I think it's better than the first.
That's why I think Smells Like Teen Spirit is like a really good analogy for this, because that's like, that was a record that some people dismissed out of hand, But other people love it and say it's like the record that changed everything. And but it's also something that brought it brought like the underground to the mainstream. And not that this is underground wrestling by any stretch of the imagination, but like I think it's one of these things that's going to be looked back upon as bringing international wrestling to the foreground again when it's been kind of like an American arena stadium product for so long.
It smells like Teen Spirit. Like I actually wasn't listening to music at the time. I was probably like seven or something. Or when did it come out? 92?
91.
91. But like, was it not ushering kind of like a new style, a new kind of type of music?
To the mainstream.
To the mainstream.
Yeah, like that style had been around for a while. Like all those bands had already put out other records.
Right. Is Okada Omega ushering anything that new
to the mainstream? To the mainstream now. Like I think that's going to be like – this is going to be one of those things that's like ushering this to the mainstream of wrestling.
I just see it as like a really good version of what's already been seen.
By you. But you're like – you guys are like the punkest of punk when it comes – if we're continuing this analogy. You guys are like –
I'd say
guys
even
into air symphonies now compared to you. Like, yeah, I'm over it. I'm like, you know, I'm into only stuff that research writes about now.
But what is like mainstream by your definition? Because to me, it's like what they're hitting on is like the hardcore WWE audience that is venturing out to watch more and more wrestling.
Exactly. And that's the mainstream audience, the WWE audience, that hardcore WWE audience, which is now, I think, going to be broadened because this, and like, that's the problem. Like, I look back on this CM Punk, John Cena match. You know, I remember this being like one of the great matches.
What a professional host. What a segue.
Exactly. But like, you know, now having watched it again and watching this whole show again, I remember loving the show so much. Mm-hmm. I don't know if it's the same feeling now, especially in the week where I got to see Okada Omega.
Right.
Because that's like, this is kind of like not an hour, but it's close.
Oh, it was a whole star and a quarter star lower exactly. rated by Dave Meltzer. Exactly. It's like, it seems like nothing now.
Exactly. But
this show, more than a lot of them, though, is so much time and place. Like that,
yeah.
Like what that promo led to, just so many different outlets looking at this, the anticipation for that show, all of the 10 million possibilities you had coming out of this show.
John. It led to this.
It did lead to this.
It led to this.
There was a downside.
It's true.
What are you talking about? This ushered in a great period for the Law Podcast of guests.
Why don't you tell that story?
Well, should we start there? Like, or should we set, like, is this how we jump in?
Welcome to Review Away. Some of this is already aired. Who knows? I don't know how I'm going to do all of this. It's John Pollock waiting, and does he even need an introduction anymore? He is DA, not Dean Ambrose, Damian Abraham with us.
I'm honored to be here, guys. I've listened to everything since we've been apart, and I've got notes, but I'll give them to you after the show. But no, thank you for providing me with hours and hours of enjoyment. But I'm glad to be back.
I can't wait to see what you or hear about what you've done over the past several weeks.
It's been pretty full on. Like, yeah. You know, like I realized that I spent my last few years of my life kind of like trying not to be touring all the time, only to be gone more. But yeah, like I've been making this show for Vice about wrestling and it's coming together. You know, it's like going all around the place. Just got back from La Paz, Bolivia.
There's wrestling in Bolivia.
There's wrestling in Bolivia.
It's been documented on DVD.
It's been documented on DVD. These are the only two video footage I could find are these two DVDs, the same DVD that I bought, one for John and one for myself. And
you also got a gift for Wei.
I got Wei a toque.
I got a Bolivian toque.
Well, I figure you could share the DVD with Wei if you really want to see.
No, I'll take your word that it's great.
Yeah. But these women.
Por mis poleras. Poleras.
Yeah, I don't know what that means. I haven't picked up any Spanish in all my
Las
time.
Las cholitas cachascanistas.
Well, the cholitas are these women. Then they dress in traditional clothing that the Andean people would wear. And this is the clothing the Spanish forced them to wear at first, but then they adopted it and made it into their traditional clothing. And through this wrestling promoter just looking for a gimmick, he put on a show featuring these women and it caught on in a way that's changed the entire perception of traditional culture there, and especially women that dress in cholita clothing, to the point now that they've altered the constitution. That's all through pro wrestling.
So you're telling me these like 50, 60 year old like grandmothers wrestle?
Yeah, they're actually a little bit younger than the photo makes them look, but yeah, they wrestle. And there's some young women too that are
holy
doing
shit.
It.
There's like,
how, and they do.
This might top our DDT review.
Yeah. Oh no, I listened to that DDT review. I want to see that show one
day. Do you want to see it?
I definitely. Oh, amazing. I tried to find it online. I was like, oh.
Okay, so like how's their wrestling? How are the matches?
The matches are it's the wrestling. We only saw one show of it, and because it happens once a week, they do these shows on Sundays. Oh, they do it twice a week, Thursdays and Sundays. It was good wrestling. The ring is rough that they're wrestling in. Uh-huh. Like the padding on the ring is not all there. It's a little uneven. There were holes in the ring. The ropes aren't the greatest. And also they're wrestling in like 30 pounds of clothing and not boots.
This is so weird.
Flats, wrestling flats. But they're doing lucha stuff too. They're climbing the ropes. They're doing like Hurricane Ranas. They're like, or sorry, Frankensteiners. But they are, they like are really going at it. And like, they're the heat, but they're the anger that gets elicited by these men that are beating them up, because it is actually for women. And this is what people told us there. It's a very violent country, and mm-hmm. domestic violence is like the highest it is in all in Latin America.
Mm-hmm.
So it's very kind of triggering for some of these women in the crowd to see these men pounding on these women.
Wow.
But then the women get the comeback.
Yeah.
And the audience explodes. But then if it's men versus men, they just sit on their hands.
It's a whole promotion, like with matches like that, of like women fighting men.
And then they'll have just like other men versus men matches that are like a little slow, a little clunky, and the audience just does not care. They're just waiting for these women.
And does the audience consist primarily of women? Is it mixed?
It's mixed. It's definitely mixed. There's a lot of tourists, but a lot of the tourists left because there was this Chilean wrestler that came out that got heat.
Okay. We're already getting derailed. What were we talking about prior to all this?
Oh, who knows? It smells like Teen Spirit.
We're talking about how we met.
Omega.
Oh, yeah.
Talking about how we met.
To CM Punk. Yeah,
yeah. How this all happened.
So after the CM Punk pay-per-view, I don't know if this – the pay-per-view?
No, it was before the pay-per-view.
Before the pay-per-view.
It was just after the pipe bomb.
Okay. Yeah.
But it was after it had been labeled the pipe bomb, which he didn't do till the next week.
Yes.
Like, he never says pipe bomb in the first promo. It's the second week.
It's the week before.
Yeah, the week before he gets that mic. And says this, and everyone else's hand, this is a microphone, but in my hand, it's pipe bomb, as immortalized by live audio wrestling.
Yeah, no, watching, cause I went back and watched a bit of the Raw going into this, not the whole thing, but it was, yeah, listening to it, it's like all these sound bites that are just like, it's like something ringing in your head. When
so,
you hear it.
So if Okada Omega was Smells Like Teen Spirit, what was the pipe bomb promo?
I think this would probably have been like, Kick Out the Jams by the MC5, or maybe the Stooges. Like, this was really a key moment, I think, in breaking out ROH. Like, you know, like, this is the first time you heard New Japan Pro Wrestling mentioned on WWE TV, as far as I know. You probably heard it mentioned before in commentary, but like, prominently featured when he's like, maybe I'll go to New Japan Pro Wrestling and defend the title.
Yeah.
I
remember
week,
Heyman
right?
tried to get, or at least he got in some, that first night that he did commentary with Jim Ross, Heyman was trying to present it more as giving guys like their real backgrounds.
Yeah.
I remember like with Benoit and stuff, but with Ring of Honor, I would imagine this was, other than the Matt Hardy run in, mm-hmm. probably the only time that Ring of Honor has been referenced on WWE television.
Which was another key moment I look back upon, because that was the moment which got me. And I think that's when I even started listening to The Law, because I was like, what the frig is going on with this world? Because this guy just jumped out of the crowd. I knew he was fired because of this relationship, but why? Is it real? You know, and that was the point that
are the best moments.
Yeah, those were exactly. But at the time the pipe bomb actually happened, I think, you know, I wasn't like, oh, that was – he just got the microphone.
Some people, I'm sure, thought that.
People still think that.
What, the
people.
Punk promo?
Yeah.
There were definitely people that felt it was real.
Yeah. And there's people still to this day, having now been to wrestling in southern Florida, mm-hmm. that probably still think it's very real.
Well, I should say like the realness of it. I mean, this was – it was a promo where he was allowed to go out there. But mm-hmm. like the mic cutting out at the end, like come on. Like obviously.
But what he said, how much of that was cleared? Prior.
Was all stuff that people were thinking too, though. Right. Like, that's the thing that would have been amazing, like, pitching that, like, mm-hmm. that, cause that was the stuff that, you know, I was hearing on your podcast. Like, I was hearing people say, like, maybe this will be better when Vince is gone. Like, you know, not dead, obviously, but like, mm-hmm. you know, this will be a better product. And like, you know, and I knew that Triple H and Stephanie were in this relationship and they were going to take over the company. But like to hear it said on the show was like, well, that's jarring.
Mm-hmm. I guess that would have been probably, was that the first time that they acknowledged like Steffi and Hunter being married within the show?
No.
Well, they got married on the show that
yeah,
time.
But they had done the divorce and it's like in storyline. That's true. In storyline.
I think that was.
Really?
Yeah.
I don't think they acknowledged the marriage before that.
I remember listening to the Law that week and it was just like, and you guys breaking it down.
That was our first live stick cam show.
Was it?
Was there after the pipe bomb? Yeah.
I don't think I've ever watched. I watched the YouTube show now, but I don't think I watched any of like the weird experiments back then.
No, they were very weird. And they continued to mod. Yeah, when we dropped Skype, when you dropped out on Skype and I had to call
the worst. Those are just the worst. I would not have the patience now to continue that.
You guys recorded three times in a row that one show?
Yeah, that was awful. Unforgiven 99.
Don't remember.
You got to do that one year as an anniversary.
Hey, that might be this show. Who knows? We haven't saved this file yet. So.
Yeah, this computer was I think this was the Dell version 1 from 1990.
Don't touch the keyboard, Damien,
I'm not going to touch anything.
No matter what you do.
Yes.
No matter what I do. Don't worry. I've lost podcasts before. I know. Now I can relate to it a lot more than when I listened to it.
Okay, we still haven't got to how we met him.
So it was
By the way, if I just want to tie it all together, we're recording on Adele, and the night we did that review of Raw, the song I used coming out of the pipe bomb was a song by Adele.
How do you remember that?
Jesus I remember Christ. That one specifically.
I wish I had your memory. Like, I wish I could experience everything in my life like in that much detail now.
It's very useless, trust me.
But I do remember in great detail us first meeting.
Okay, so we went out. My theory was that here's this huge story in pro wrestling. And everyone said, well, this is the Austin moment. This is WWE's return to the mainstream media with popularity. And I said, let's go out and do like a Streeter segment and see how many people actually even know who CM Punk is, much less this promo. And let's just say we did not run into just about, I don't think we ran into anyone that had any clue of what this was. And it was kind of just, this is a very in the bubble moment, which maybe it could grow into more. But in this example, and we'll get into how this did on pay-per-view, which kind of confirmed this. I mean, this was big to wrestling fans. It had not penetrated outside of it, in my opinion.
Well, it hadn't, but there were ways that
there were outlets that were now covering it.
I remember talking to my friend Tom Bryan, who I do a wrestling podcast I haven't done forever with. But like Tom, he and I just connected because he was working at Pitchfork at the time. And he was like, what's this pipe bomb thing? I watched it. It's pretty crazy. And then we were talking about him really amped for this pay-per-view. And he ended up interviewing CM Punk for GQ.
Yeah, GQ did a thing with him. You know, like Jim Rome was trying to get like major outlets, I should say, like it got their attention, which was key. I just don't know how much of this was bringing back lapsed fans, for instance, like how many of them were coming back. Like this pay-per-view we can go over now, it did 205,000 buys, which was, I mean, below what the Extreme Rules show had done a few months earlier. The number that was impressive was of those 205, 146,000 were from North America, which was their highest number in North America for a non-Big Four show in over a year. So that was impressive, that number. But this was hardly a massive success on pay-per-view. It was an encouraging number. I think it certainly showed signs that they have hit something that has got people's attention. But it wasn't as though this was something where all these fans came back and bought this show, for instance.
No, but I would argue that this was the first time they had broken through to the new zeitgeist, which is like this sort of like meme internet culture. And it was before like memes were like a thing that they are now, but like the sort of like that now wrestling exists in very comfortably. But this was like kind of the return to kind of like wrestling is cool.
Right.
You can be interested in wrestling and it not be like.
Well, that's what's looked on now is that there's so many people that are working at these sites that are running these outlets now that grew up during that popularity boom that were wrestling fans. Mm-hmm. And I always looked, CM Punk was kind of the gateway for these people to cover this in a way of he was a link to that audience, not just him solely, but I think he really opened the door to provide that kind of coverage.
Let's just say I don't see Vice covering an event featuring Sheamus as a WWE champion.
No.
You know what I mean? Like, here's a guy in CM Punk who I think any person under the age of 35 would think would be the coolest dude. And now he's your representative of this product. And this promo was really kind of his coming out party for that.
Well, and also he's Punk. You know, and like, yep. And I think like you look at Vice and it's like run by a bunch of people that were in punk bands and did punk zines.
That looked like him.
That looked like him, that have tattoos mm-hmm. like him. And so it became like, yeah, like it was cool. And also he was that wrestler, you know, and I'm watching this show. I don't know if I, you know, if I, he's my, as much of my favorite wrestler of this period as he was, but like he had that credibility because he had fought Samoa Joe. He had been like this ROH guy. He had like, he had put in the time on this like indie level.
He had indie cred.
He had cred, yeah.
Mm-hmm. He also had like punk cred, as you mentioned. Yeah. Like he could go to these outlets and speak completely fluently.
Yeah, and he hangs out with the real deal people. Like it's not like, you know, he's like hanging out with like the MTV pop punk band. He's like hanging out with like hardcore bands, and he's hanging out with Rancid, and he's like friends with these bands.
But compare that to what was the face of the WWE prior to that? It was the John Cena's, you know.
Well, this is key. This is in the midst of that year long build up to Rock and Cena, which became an element of the promo mm-hmm. for Punk as well.
Mm-hmm.
The fact that they have earmarked their main event, and that was just one of the long list of issues that Punk could bring up here that they were in the midst of. And some people were intrigued with that match, others were not. And it was like this divide amongst the talent as well that were either understanding the business reason of doing this Rock match or looking at their next generation of talent. And we've got a roster where we're trying to create new stars, but delving back to the past. And that's become a pattern at mm-hmm. WrestleMania.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, when you look at Punk as well, I mean, you look at the guys that they have now gone out and hired since 2011. I mean, do we give too much credit to Punk for ushering that in? Like, granted, you did have Bryan Danielson in the midst here, but I think Punk was more of an eye-opener to the company of this subdivision of pro wrestling that we're not tapping into. This was still when FCW was running. Their hiring practices were much different in 2011. And I look at Punk as a big reason for bridging that gap to now where you look at the makeup of the roster and what they're more open-minded towards.
Yeah, like this is like, you know, isn't this the same time Bill DeMott's chasing Kenny Omega out of developmental? Like it's like
Omega had left already by this point, but
like, yeah, like CM Punk's like the guy that I think, you know, for Daniel Bryan or Bryan Danielson, like he opened that door. Like he's the guy that I think brought.
This is coming off when Caval had just given his notice because
yeah.
he saw
yeah.
he was going nowhere yeah. at the end of 2010.
And they weren't treating Daniel Bryan all that well either, if you remember.
Oh, he's a joke on this show.
Yeah.
I mean, he was a punchline.
Yeah. And even Mystico, you know, like the Sin Cara, like, you know, yeah. they bring up, he's like an international sensation at one point in an audio commentary. But like, I think now a guy like that, they would handle differently. Like, look at the way they handle, like, all the guys that they brought in from Mexico and Japan now, where they bring them into developmental first, give them a chance to kind of, like, figure out their style a little bit that they want to do in WWE for them. And it's...
But then you have, like, a Grand Metalik who, you know, kind of is Sin Cara, not even a Sin Cara.
No, exactly. But I think, like, you know, like, having just seen Caristico or Mystico, whatever now the name is, but like he's still that good, you know, like, and it's just like it's crazy that he didn't find that like any traction.
Yeah, I think with him it went both ways. I mean, there were issues with him himself and also the introduction of him. I mean, coming in with a specific style and then trying to mold it. You had the language barriers and you had a guy that understood, like he was a megastar in Mexico, and now he's coming into the WWE where he's starting several pegs down. Like, I think they were invested in him, but it was going to be, you know, as they've said, with our playbook, and it became just a very difficult relationship.
And as we've just seen with that whole Maximo La Mascara situation with the car, Mexican wrestling is like totally different culture, and like stuff that flies down there would never fly.
Well,
American wrestling.
We'll get into this show. from July the 17th of 2011 at the Allstate Arena in Chicago. And The Raw coming into this show did a 2.91 rating and 4.4 million viewers. That compared to this past week, which did a, I believe, 2.5 million viewers. So that is our comparison.
But even at, in 2011, was that – were those stellar numbers?
No, I remember you guys talking at that time on the show and it would be like, oh, these numbers compared to like this point in 2002, you know, or half. You know, and I think that's just the way ratings are going, unfortunately. But like this stuff is now – I would argue the market penetration that WWE has now in that sort of zeitgeist is way further, you know, like online and kind of like the way they're hitting people now. Like it's not – the product's not as good maybe, but maybe it's better.
It's I think it's a lot of different factors, but I think that you can certainly look at, I mean, whether you want to argue about the popularity level of the WWE today versus 2011, the fact is that the metrics that are most valued are down significantly.
Yeah.
I mean, it's great to say it would be like me and Wei stating, all right, we got we got 1,000 downloads for this show, but 5,000 people bootlegged it. It's like, how valuable are those 5,000 people to us? Yeah, they're listening to us, but they're of no value to me. None.
Well, it depends what you're trying to do with this thing. Like, if you're charging per episode, then yeah. But if you're, like, trying to get your brand out there so your brand can move units of T-shirts and toys and cereal boxes and cross-promotional things, and if you're more worried about how your product looks to the new emerging Indian market, like, you know, like you want the review away Indian market to be blowing up.
We're working on it.
You don't necessarily care if it's bootlegged. You want it to be out there. You're like, what your goal is, like WWE's goal isn't like, they're not worried about getting TV channels ratings anymore.
They should be though.
That's
160 million a year and you lose that TV money. That changes their company.
That TV money's going away anyway. Like
I don't know if it's
not going away. You're right. It's not going away. It's going away from them anyway. So I think they're like, now they're just kind of like, how do we?
Can they slow the bleeding though? Can they slow it down and try to maximize the TV era as much as they can before they move completely digital?
Because it's perfectly sound to say, hey, 15 years from now, it's going to be all digital. Like I don't begrudge the WWE going heavy into maintaining a presence on YouTube and other digital outlets, boosting your network performance numbers. However, it's like the money isn't there yet.
Oh yeah, no.
Like YouTube, that is a money loser at the moment for the company, and it's, you've got to weigh this.
And they're cannibalizing themselves with the TV product right now because, like, you know, it's like a couple. It's like when The Gap was really popular, and then all of a sudden you had Banana Republic and you had Old Navy, and it's like, why would you shop at The Gap? If you want something cheaper, you go to Old Navy. And if you want something that
– Old Navy, they're all owned by the same company.
Yeah, exactly. They're cannibalizing themselves, right?
Okay.
And now if you're a fan of wrestling, you watch NXT. And if you're like a fan of you know, like they're like you, everyone knows the superior product of the same product. The superior version of the same product is available over here. So that number is taking away from it now. And then there's like, you know, there's the perception that SmackDown might be better wrestling than Raw. So that's taking away from its number now. Like, I just think.
So you're saying their aim is to more create, like kind of tiered or specifically targeted products for different demographics.
Yeah. Like, I think they just want to own wrestling.
Or is there a chance that people just leave wrestling altogether? You know, is there a chance you don't wear Gap or Banana Republic and you just wear black t-shirts?
Until you see Okada and Omega pop up on your Facebook.
And you wear Uniqlo.
And then you're like,
they are the Uniqlo.
This is the new Uniqlo.
This was the second annual Money in the Bank pay-per-view. And just as a concept, did you like the idea of this being broken away from your WrestleMania match to its own pay-per-view? And now that we've had – it's an annual event and one of the big shows of the year.
Anything to kind of – and I know this is like goes counter to what everyone else says, but anything to make these – at this point, especially these like meaningless B shows seem different and special, I would go for. And like, obviously the cage match stipulation is kind of ridiculous because like you have to build to those a little bit more. So I thought a Money in the Bank breakaway show. Yeah. More power to it. Like, you know, WrestleMania is a show on its own. If this one of these things can stand on its own and carry a pay-per-view by itself. Yes.
It's largely a protected gimmick. Mm-hmm. I mean, everyone talks about bringing back the King of the Ring. When was the last King of the Ring that meant anything for the winner? Like, it's just, to me, it was something they beat into the ground themselves, whereas you have everything. Like, this to me is a way bigger thing than a King of the Ring winner ever received.
No,
this
is absolutely.
This is 9 times out of 10, meaning that this is a guy that is going to get that big push and moved mm-hmm. up to the main event with very few exceptions. And we're going on 12 years now that this has become a very protected and over stipulation match.
It doesn't mean the King of the Ring is a bad idea. It's just their treatment of it.
Exactly. It would take a lot of rehab. But I would say everything you would want out of that, you have here. If we had both, I think you would water that down somewhat.
Mm-hmm.
If just everything.
The way it spaces out is good because the Rumble kind of plays the same role,
yep.
right? And then you have that leading into WrestleMania, and then Money in the Bank is kind of positioned as leading into SummerSlam. So I think the timing is good. I'm for a pay-per-view that's only Money in the Bank.
And the storyline picks up too for the rest of the summer because you have like this like added element on the TV show that mm-hmm. is always there if they book it properly. And also this became like a cliche in wrestling. Like, you know, New Japan has it. Like, you know, there's like a, mm-hmm. the Money in the Bank thing is like just like a thing in wrestling.
The cash in thing I think is a brilliant concept and, has added a lot, I'd say.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I think this cash in is one of my favorites, or attempted cash ins is one of my favorites of all time.
Are we on pace for a blockbuster?
Oh,
Wade, do you have to get going?
No, I'm good.
We also have to have lunch after this so we can talk about all the stuff we can't talk about on air.
It might be dinner. we'll find out. First of all, thank you for moving days. This would have been awful the day prior.
I understand.
There's no way I could appreciate done this.
There's all the McGregor Mayweather stuff. John was busy with.
I either was interviewed or did interviews. There were 6 of them on Thursday on top of putting the show together and regular stuff. It would have...
But do you think this is going to be bigger than Mayweather-Pacquiao as far as like a media thing?
It's so hard to say. I don't know. I really don't know at this point.
Maybe not internationally. Like that's like
it's hard for me to say because like I'm more of an MMA fan and like Mayweather-Pacquiao I heard about, but because I don't follow boxing, I probably didn't hear as much about it. I'll hear more about Conor and Mayweather for sure.
Yeah, but I think this might be more of like a. You know, like, once again, that thing that's kind of like that internet zeitgeist that exists now. Like, this is more in that kind of world where it's like, you're right.
We've yet to hear a pipe bomb. I mean, who knows what the buildup is going to be like for that, right?
Well, yeah, there's like a lot of like perfectly matched angles, you know, yeah. Connor being this young father in a new family, Mayweather obviously having issues with.
Oh, and those will be brought
stuff.
Up.
Oh my gosh. I can only imagine how they'll be brought up.
Oh my God.
I'm curious how many Irish fans travel to this event that won't even get into the building. Like they will be, sure. The tickets are going to be priced at such a level that there's no way an average person getting in there.
You'd have to know someone too, I think, to get them. Like I think they're going to be sold out like immediately.
But
really
so wait,
you've been at McGregor fights where it's like there's people that go over there without even going to the event. They're there just to party with other Irish.
They'll
fans.
Have to do spillovers. They'll have to do spillover seating, like at WrestleMania and like all
like
these
closed circuit could do very well if you convince this Irish contingent who have followed this guy faithfully.
Is it in Vegas?
Yeah.
It's in Vegas.
Every T-Mobile bar will do well, but you'll have a lot more seats at the T-Mobile.
You do have more, but I mean, this is going to be scaled so high.
Mm-hmm. Every casino is going to be sold out.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But, I'm curious, like, is there the same incentive for an Irish person to go to Las Vegas to see McGregor very most likely lose?
He's got on paper, if you're going to buy into the myth of McGregor, he does on paper look like, without knowing it, like the superior, he's bigger. He's got the reach advantage. I know. But
they're
still.
Playing a different sport.
Like if you want to believe.
All you need is
he's younger.
The whole crux of this promotion is creating reasonable doubt.
Exactly.
And
there's none though, I think.
I think they're going to push it, man. Like
this
guy's in his prime. He's taking on a 40-year-old Floyd.
Floyd is still in his prime.
They've built him. Like he beat Diaz after getting his ass kicked, and that guy was bigger. So I'm saying
that's
like he's
not
been
boxing
built
though.
But
they're going to show. They're going to show that fight that Floyd had with Shane Mosley, where Mosley landed that one great shot on him, and they're going to say all Conor has to do is land once. That's
you're right.
all they're going to tell
you're
you.
Right.
And I'm not picking Conor McGregor to win this fight. All I'm saying is the promotion if people can just say maybe, they've won.
It's Wolf tickets, you know, and that's what I'm curious about is how they sell those Wolf tickets because they're up for a challenge, I would say.
Do you think he gets punched? Do you think he goes for like shoots for a takedown just so he can get the takedown on TV?
No.
Do you think he does something controversial to like try to warrant a rematch out of this?
No, I really feel the best case scenario is this guy either
goes to his back,
has an entertaining performance and is stopped, or very best case scenario goes the distance and almost gets the endorsement of Floyd at the end of it, that this guy fighting in front of this much attention is just a gigantic star.
Yeah.
Much like, you know, Canelo losing to Floyd, and he has gone on to become an incredible draw even after losing to Floyd. So I think that's your best case scenario, that Conor is seen and talked about for 2 months by outlets that never touch MMA, and he fights on a gigantic stage that could, I mean, who knows how much this does on pay-per-view. I don't know if this can hit the Floyd Pacquiao number. 4.6 is, I never thought that number would be touched in our lifetime.
Yeah,
4.6 million buys. We're talking about a show that 210,000 homes purchased.
We're talking about a show that changed the face of wrestling forever, John.
Yeah, this is called perspective. I have only gotten through 2 points on my notes so far, so I'm going to be
able to show. I don't think we're going to keep some of these matches too heavy detail.
Oh, yeah. We're going to extensively talk about the Justin Gabriel influence.
It's a one or two match show.
So the show starts with a CM Punk video with this clock sound effect to emphasize his WWE contract coming to an end at midnight. In fact, his contract ended on the Friday, and he stated he signed a 2-day extension to get them through the pay-per-view. And the story Punk has always relayed was that his contract was signed midway through the show.
Yeah.
The true story.
That's what he said. And I think you can buy the idea that their backup plan was a Del Rio cash-in. They did it a month later. They could have easily done it on this show if that was where they were going.
You think they didn't have it figured out? Because I know Triple H now, and a lot of people have come out and said like they had it figured out much longer ahead of time. Like they would have let him go out there and say what he said about the company and then walk out on the company?
I don't even think why even have him beat Cena if he hadn't signed it? I don't know.
You're right. You could have had Cena win, and
I don't put it past Punk to, you know, kayfabe the internet audience.
Maybe wrestling, works differently with contracts, but way up to the wire. But every contract I've signed, like, it's like a long, like, he didn't get his lawyer to read. Maybe that's what he waited to that moment to ceremonially sign it. But I'm sure they had come to terms a while in advance. Like, it took me. I'm like 4 episodes into my wrestling TV show and just signed my contract.
Right.
So, well, what do you think he would have done if he had left at this time in 2011?
MMA.
Yeah, UFC wouldn't have been an option.
He probably would have gone to maybe Evolve. You know, or done something with Paul Heyman and Gabe or something. You know, Gabe's kind of told, like, you know, there were talks of like some promotion happening at some point.
Or TNA?
I don't think he already hated TNA, right? Yeah, they had that massive falling out over the
Well, if it had timed out the year prior, that prior summer was when Heyman was deep in talks with TNA. That would have been a bridge for him at that time, but that never happened with Heyman and Gabe and Lagana.
I see him just taking a break and probably not even like kind of the hiatus he ended up taking.
If he really wanted to have done MMA, he could have done it and probably would have gone a better direction because he wouldn't have gotten the UFC offer. He would have had to go a different route. And
you don't think he would have gotten a UFC offer?
Not in 2011.
I don't think he would have been interested.
I don't think they do that because they didn't need a CM Punk at that time. They took a lot of scrutiny for that, and they were you got to remember at the end of 2014, they had a really rough year. And I think they did that as almost like a shot to the system to bring in something that was going to attract a lot of attention. 2011, I don't see them going that route with him.
I don't think he was burned out on wrestling yet. I think he would have gone.
Obviously not.
Yeah, like he was like – it took a good 3 more years for the WWE to beat his love of wrestling out of him. You know, like he would have, I think, shown up in – maybe it was Japan. You know, that would have timed out well with like – was that around the time of the start of the Bullet Club?
Not that.
No, really.
Okay. Wow, you just made every internet wrestling nerd just very upset. Fantasize.
Honestly,
CM Punk leading the Bullet Club.
You can lay out all these scenarios. He made the best decision.
Yeah. Oh, God. Well, absolutely. For wrestling, I think he did too. Because like he slugged it out for a couple more years and increased the coolness factor of WWE.
Would have easily had his biggest earning years in 2012 and 2013. I mean, yeah, he had his burnout at the end of it, but those were his have to have been his most lucrative years.
Yeah, and he was still super popular in those even his burnt out years.
So is that 3 points now that you've gone through?
No, I didn't even get to – oh, I'm not even done point number three. So they show clips of the big promo, cutting promos on Vince McMahon, John Laurinaitis. Says how Cena kisses Vince's ass, just like Dwayne. And Vince says that Cena will be fired if he loses the title to Punk. I fucking hated that stipulation that they added at the end. It's like you had a hot match, and it was like throwing a stip on top of something that was already huge.
It allowed him in, when, you know, without spoiling it, when in the end of the match, when Vince comes and Laurinaitis come out, it allows Cena to still be the babyface. For keeping this match going at the sacrifice of his career.
I feel like there's definitely a point where they over-dramatized too much to the point where like it took away from the believability of the entire angle.
You had a guy that you were that at least a segment of the audience legitimately believed could leave. Zero people thought Cena was leaving as well. You had just done a firing angle with him over the Nexus stuff a few months earlier. That was a joke. He didn't even miss a TV. So to add this on, this was a completely unbelievable stipulation that, yeah, Cena and Punk will be gone after tonight. It was just to me.
It took away from something that was already very believable on its own after the promo. But like in hindsight, I watched something like this and I watched the angle leading up to it. And to me, it's like, it's hard for me to look at it like a documentary. It's more like a bio, like dramatized biopic using elements from reality to tell their story, you know?
Commentary team tonight was Michael Cole, Jerry Lawler, and Booker T. And this was still in the midst of the brand split. So we had Raw and SmackDown. Featured throughout this show. And I guess we had Cole and Lawler, who were part of the Raw team, and Booker T on SmackDown, if I remember things correctly, from 2011.
I remember this being milder than it is now with JBL. Like, I remember this sort of this being like, oh, it's just so milder. much kinder and gentler.
Milder, but like Booker T was like, I didn't like him at all on this show.
He wasn't good during this period. He's gotten much better.
He was so loud and just like took – like overtook a lot of the other commentators, way more than like a color commentator should. You know,
Michael Cole straight up calls him the cliche machine.
Yeah, it was too much.
This
of that.
Was also like the, it was still Michael Cole as the heel character, which I hated. I just hate going back and watching Michael Cole, who has to almost go back and forth. Like there's times he has to call it straight, and others where he just naturally goes into this character, and it's very much like Josh Matthews, where he's a good heel, but not in this role where you're the play-by-play guy.
Yeah.
So opening match was the SmackDown Money in the Bank ladder match. Sin Cara taking on Wade Barrett, Justin Gabriel, Sheamus, Cody Rhodes, Heath Slater, Daniel Bryan, and Kane. What a mashup of talent in 2011. And
it's like the hottest indie billing and WWE guys.
Yeah. Jerry Lawler asks, Booker, have you ever seen a superstar make such a big impact in such a short time than Sin Cara? Yeah. This 24 hours from his wellness violation announcement that he would be gone.
Oh, so
for
that's
30
what,
days.
Oh, okay.
That's why, well, they did an injury angle and then amazingly he was suspended the next day. Barrett came out to just this awful, awful theme song that I don't remember at all, but all of these themes.
Was it
was
it the Core theme song?
It might have been. I think the Core had been disbanded.
The Core.
Do
you remember that?
It had been disbanded.
With 2 hours. Ugh.
The Core.
I thought Sheamus' theme song was one of the worst ever. And
they had
had
such a slew of shit songs during
Roy fights and he frights and he goes through the dark and the dark. And it's like
too many limes.
Too
many limes.
Too many limes. Yeah. Lobster head. But like, it's one of those like so bad that like it stuck with him. You know, I can't picture Sheamus coming out to anything else.
I think that's the thing about Sheamus is like, they're like, that guy's a monster. He's huge. Like, I got my kids got a Sheamus book and we looked through it and they don't.
Sheamus book?
Yeah. Like it's a book about Sheamus for kids.
Like a kid's book about Sheamus?
Yeah.
I'd love to see this
book. Oh, it's, I'll bring
it in. What have you learned?
It's like a novel?
It's like basically like a summary of his career up until the point that he beat Daniel Bryan at WrestleMania.
I love that.
Yeah, the peak.
I love that this is like what our kids are using to learn now.
So my kids thought Sheamus was like the most impressive wrestler, but then when you see him, in reality, they don't present them that way at all. And so, I don't know, like they've just labeled them with like the Irish thing so bad, and then they've given him the worst.
Remember when he won the King of the Ring, and they gave him like the Lord of the Rings thing?
Yeah,
like, that was awful.
Yeah,
I thought that Wade Barrett was someone drastically just could have been so much more. Like I saw a ton of potential in this guy, and he got saddled with so much stuff that he got through, but was just post Nexus. I mean, this guy was just put through the ringer of characters and gimmick changes, and
he also like he. I remember he was a big Manic Street Preachers fan and had mentioned them in an interview, and the guy from the Manic Street Preachers was like, "Oh, we'd love to do a theme song for you," and then apparently WWE was like, "Who?" But that would have been like such like that would have broken them through in England in a different way. Like they would have been brought out in England in a major way because that band's huge in England, you know.
Well, Batista, we don't even know if this Guardians shit's going to be any good.
They make a lot of missteps in pop culture analysis.
Then Daniel Bryan comes out and Daniel Bryan is introduced and Michael Cole says, "Even nerds are allowed in Money in the Bank." The nerd,
yeah.
The vegan nerd.
Where were we in the evolution of the whole Cole heel character? Because he had the match with Jerry Lawler at WrestleMania.
He's coming out of it now, right?
Like, yeah, we were slowly evolving out of it.
No, what was his feud with Brian? Because that was with Swagger.
That started on NXT.
Oh, okay.
And that was kind of where it really took form was feuding with Daniel Bryan,
siding with The Miz.
Yes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And later, it's like all nerd jokes throughout this. He's mentioning that Daniel Bryan could star in Revenge of the Nerds. There was a sign in the crowd that read, "Seen enough, Kara." And then the match begins. Bryan hit this suicide dive to Barrett, and his legs caught on the ropes while landing, which looked frightening. Gabriel hit a Topicon Hero to the floor. Lots of big stuff starting off, including a Spanish fly by Sin Cara to Bryan off of the top that got a big reaction. And Booker's pick was for Sin Cara to win the match. So clearly not in the know.
They gave Sin Cara, like, maybe – I wonder what the original plans were before the Rollins violation, because they gave him some, like, huge spots. Like, he had that insane crossbody to the floor. You know, like, he had some big moments. Like, I wonder if he didn't get the wellness violation, like
– from what I recall, it wasn't exactly like he was doing all that well prior to this either.
We had flubbed the entrance or something a couple times by this point, right?
And some of the matches, too.
Yeah.
So they set up a ladder between the apron and the announcer's desk, and this is where Sheamus puts Sin Cara through it with a powerbomb, breaking the ladder, and Sin Cara's hand is twitching, which Dr. Lawler identifies as nerve damage and hopes it isn't a spinal injury, and he's taken out on a stretcher. So that was the end of Sin Cara.
Do you think like we should be seeing more or less of the twitching cell? Like Devon used to do it a lot. Like Devon would do it every time he took something big. So
I was just thinking, how would this change now in the wake of Daniel Bryan? Like what like the commentary? Yeah. I'm sure they would not be saying the same sort of stuff about the spinal injury and the nerve damage.
Do you think they would shy away from that because of Brian?
So. They've laid back on, you know, they used to make concussion jokes a lot. Those have kind of been.
Now it's broken limbs again because, like, you know, there's no real long term there.
Yeah. Now it's a loss of momentum.
A loss of momentum. Yeah, the battle for momentum.
Booker says he always tried to stay out of these types of matches. Cole says, "You were in a Money in the Bank at WrestleMania." He says, "Yeah, I tried to talk myself out of that match unsuccessfully." Barrett, Gabriel, and Slater tease an alliance. So you really had to be living in the moment here to remember the core. But they turn on Barrett. Gabriel and Slater then race up the ladder.
Do you think that was the inspiration for the Elite and the Bullet Club?
No.
Like them breaking away from NXT?
Not at all.
Over Nexus?
Not at all.
Cody Rhodes then tipped the ladder over, and this is when Cody was doing the face mask after the 619 to the face by Ray. They did a doomsday device, Brian and Kane did, to Sheamus.
A huge LOD chance.
Yeah, in Chicago. I mean, it was smart there.
Mm-hmm.
Cole is still doing all the nerd stuff deep into the match. Totally didn't fit the tone, I felt. Cole and Booker are then doing this exchange, and Lawler has to cut them off to focus on this ladder match, this being like 25 minutes into the show. Barrett and Sheamus are trying to lift Slater by the ribs with the ladder off the top turnbuckle, but then he falls down to the floor. Rhodes then hit a disaster kick. Barrett hit Wasteland. They're going through all these finishes, including a Justin Gabriel 450 off the ladder on the top rope to Kane. And then Barrett, Brian, and Rhodes are on the ladder. Brian applied a guillotine to Rhodes. He's knocked down. Then Brian blocks Wasteland off the ladder with these downward elbows and a head kick, knocks him off, and it was only at this point that the crowd, like, none of them bought this guy winning until the last guy fell, and it was like you hit the on button, and the crowd was like, holy shit, the nerd might win this. And Brian grabs the briefcase, and this place fucking exploded. 24 minutes, 26 seconds. It was easily the biggest thing they had done with Brian since, I guess, the Nexus return at SummerSlam, because he had been just doing nothing, like having good matches with Dolph Ziggler and stuff, but was...
Was this before or after the Gail Kim boyfriend-girlfriend?
I think this was in the middle of it, if not right before the Kim stuff, I think.
Didn't he also have the thing with the Bellas, too?
Like, I think this was after Gail,
the Bellas
are
trying to break him off.
Well, and they were like, that was the virgin vegan thing, joke, right?
That's how they actually met and started dating, I think.
Who would know that that would inspire like a child eventually?
It's amazing.
You know? So maybe, there you go. Now, do you feel bad for talking so much shit on it back then, John?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. What a shame.
You could have denied them love.
Cole called it as a big deal here and Brian's biggest career victory, and Booker claims that he picked him all along. And Cole asks if we could be looking at a future world champion. So it was just interesting to watch where they were on the Daniel Bryan front at this point in 2011. And believe me, this was a guy that made his opportunities because he was supposed to be the nerd who failed on his cash-in. Like, that was the idea for him.
Really? That was the original plan?
It was supposed to just be he would come in and fail.
Hmm.
And the day he cashed it in, he wasn't even at the pay-per-view. They had to bring him in from an autograph session. He wasn't even booked to be at the arena. And it was just to be a short-term thing because I think it was Big Show was hurt, maybe.
He never did.
Or Mark Henry.
He never had his great run, though. Like, he never – like, that was kind of like when he –
Well, he had the big WrestleMania moment.
He had the big WrestleMania moment, but he never had that run afterwards where he was, like, on the guy because then the injury stuff. Yeah.
Which was only to go to SummerSlam. Like, he was going to be in the Cena role that year at SummerSlam, dropping the title to Lesnar.
Yeah.
But anyway,
that would have been a huge. You could imagine like Daniel Bryan versus Brock Lesnar. That would have been he would have made that match so awesome. Like he would have like told the best David Goliath story ever.
He talks about this on Total Divas or Total Bellas one episode where I mean this was like recently, obviously after this was while he was training for his comeback, but before deciding to retire, where he was in the Performance Center with Sami Zayn and he was he's you know kind of depressed. So Brie takes him to the Performance Center to like just kind of be around wrestling. And so Brian's having a conversation with Zayn, telling him how he's been working on a new style and he's essentially kind of gearing up for a potential fight with Brock Lesnar where he would stay low and stay grounded and just basically work a lot of kind of like ground-based offense. Like
the Inoki.
Like
on his back doing the kicks.
Not on his back, but like he'd be staying low, crawling on the ground and like doing a less impactful style that would work – you know, in his opinion, great against a monster like Brock.
Yeah, that'd be awesome.
That would have been awesome to see.
Awesome.
I'm pretty sure this is detailed in Brian's book that even this win was just a day, like the choice they made that day. This was not anything with this giant plan for him. When you look at the guys in this match, like it seemed like it was just a coin flip. And Brian was hardly the most pushed guy here. Mm-hmm. I think most would have looked at maybe Cody winning this, possibly Barrett. Like, those would have probably been the likely choices. Like, Brian was just something to do something different with and not even with the idea that they'd put the title on him.
Even the way he won the match, he had to kind of backdoor his way in throughout the entire match and, you know, ultimately not necessarily earning it completely himself, just kind of lucking into that final spot.
That's what I kind of – looking back, when we'll get to the main event, that's what I kind of thought about the main event too. It wasn't like the definitive victory I remember it being. It was more like CM Punk lucking into it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's just amazing to watch Brian's run where it's so many just pure coincidences and luck that led to so much. And someone who's totally downplayed in his popularity is AJ. Pairing was key, I thought.
Yeah. Oh, right.
Yes. And he lucked into using fucked up his entrance music in ROH, you know, and like, he just got lucked so in. Lucky. He lucked in, right? Like a lot of lucky breaks in that guy's career.
They all.
How long? Like I thought he was going to, but
no, he used it for two shows. The first two HDNet tapings, and then he jumped after those. So
I heard Gabe hated the song though.
That's not what I heard. I will tell you one thing.
Yeah.
Gabe Sapolsky's love for Neurosis
and you.
No, the fucked up thing. He likes fucked up. He loves Neurosis. Like, you go to his place, it's all just kids' artwork, his kids' artwork. Loves his kid, probably first and foremost, obviously. But then Neurosis.
Wow.
And, like, very little wrestling memorabilia. Like, a lot of Neurosis posters.
Would he see him on a two-day double bill? Neurosis I night one and night two?
He's written – he told me he wrote shows based on Neurosis' music.
Wow.
Really?
Incredible.
So there you go. Matt Riddle. Every time you see Matt Riddle in the ring,
I can't wait to see.
Thinks of Souls of Zero.
Somebody should do a little TV special on Gabe.
A whole show?
Yeah.
Maybe one day someone will.
It's a three-nighter.
I brought up the fact that you do impressions of it.
You didn't.
Yes! Back for the Robbie Brookside name drop comments, which I also hear when I'm not here, John. Your allusions to that.
You already got your Robbie Brookside comment in, like, before I could even sit down.
Because we weren't taping yet.
Yeah, that means it's a natural name drop. I mean, you're just naturally that vain.
It wasn't involving me at all, that story. Yeah, it was involving me a little bit.
Earlier tonight, they show Vince McMahon arriving in a limo with John Laurinaitis, who Cole continually calls John Laurinaitis. Okay. Ha ha.
This was John Laurinaitis' first on-screen appearance as Vince's lackey, right?
Could have been. I don't know if he was on TV before this. They did the contract negotiation on Raw before this, but I think that was just with Vincent Punk in the ring.
And didn't he bring him up before?
In the pipe bomb promo.
In the pipe bomb promo.
He was brought up, yes. Yeah. Yes. And brought up consistently in OVW. I mean, when they would fuck around Cornette's booking, they would put the heat on John Laurinaitis and storyline to explain it.
Would this be his biggest run in wrestling? Probably like people that like
what
to
like,
some fans
kind of like a main event.
He was really good, like during his time in All Japan. Like not a featured guy, but he had a very good run there.
I mean, like would he be making his most money at this point in his career? Like over All Japan.
He was a legit executive here, so he was probably making
And now he's an on-screen guy too, and he's like in the main event.
Will he be remembered most for this?
Yeah,
probably.
But in North America, definitely, I guess, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Or the Radical Dudes or whatever.
Yeah, because he had that entire, like he was the authority figure afterwards. Mm-hmm. I mean, he became, for the Punk feud, I mean, it wasn't a Punk Vince dynamic. It was Punk Laurinaitis.
And he had a match, right? Like, it builds.
He did several matches.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. So, yeah. Versus CM Punk.
Up next was Mrs. Danielson, Brie Bella, challenging Kelly Kelly for the Divas title. This was also a segment I watched on the Raw leading up to this. To watch this storyline, it was all built around Nikki and Brie bullying Kelly, that she's a stick figure that starves herself. It was just awful. It was just awful. Yeah. Then Kelly makes her entrance, and Lawler says that these girls are so naughty, they deserve a good spank.
Different times. Yeah. This is only 6 years ago.
Yeah. Well, I was thinking about Juan Cena. Could you imagine them trying to pull Juan Cena off today? Like,
is Juan Cena that bad?
Oh, it's pretty that bad. Way. It's
really?
Pretty. I can't see that going over well at all.
Mm.
Eve Torres was in the corner of Kelly, and Nikki was in Bree's corner. Someone in the crowd had a sign that read, "Save Tag Team Wrestling. Sign Max and Jeremy Buck." Their TNA personas at this time, in 2010, or 2011, I should say.
That person could have bought stock back then.
Yeah, if only they knew.
I had to remember who those were.
The Bellas accused Kelly of being airbrushed for her Maxim photo shoot and being a scrawny stick figure that has led to this battle. Kelly did this handstand on the edge of the apron and got dumped to the floor as Lawler is telling skinny jokes. Because if you go camping with Kelly Kelly, she can rub her legs together to start a fire. Everyone cringed. Kelly fought back. As Lawler says, she appears to be a screamer. Kelly also hit the worst face buster I've ever seen and then hit her famouser called the K2 for the win at 4:48. My comment here was pretty bad. And then we cut to Nikki yelling, "She doesn't even eat. How could you not beat that?" to Brie. So this was a pre-Brie mode.
It was, yeah, it was pre, you know, women being taken seriously as professional wrestlers. The crowd did not certainly seem at all into it. Though I will say, I feel like they got a better reaction than your typical 205 Live match. You know, I'll say that. It's hard to tell, like, whether
what a level we're at for 205 Live.
No. It's hard to say whether, like, Brie or Kelly were worse in ring. Do either of you have an opinion?
It's debatable.
I want to read Kelly's book now. I think she would have an amazing.
She's on that reality show, like Superstar Wives or like Hockey Wives
and Girlfriends. Oh, really?
Yeah.
Okay, because I think she would have like her experience in that company.
She was on the main roster at 19, which is kind of nuts.
Exactly.
She had already been on the roster 5 years at this point.
And just before the enlightenment of the company, like, you know, at least where it is now, you know, like.
There were all those rumors about her, like, coming back at the Hall of Fame for something, but like, she would not fit in.
She's able for three.
She did. Yeah. She would not fit in at all, though, in the current dynamic.
I will say, I felt Kelly, she was definitely stigmatized, and I'm not saying she was like this extreme talent, but you look at women like her, like Candace, like they had to overcome preconceived notions, and I felt that they worked as hard as they could. They weren't great.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not all that different from Trish, who she came in, she was not great at the beginning either. I mean, she was taking her first bumps when she was signed by the WWF, and she was able to overcome that. I don't think Kelly and Candace did, but this era was like a pretty low point where they were given very little, but to the same point here, even in a 5-minute match, it's not as if you watched this and saw these women as like untapped potential. I mean, it's just where things were. And they were also, as you see many of the women, like they were very much limited and like they didn't want them doing things outside of what they believed was women's wrestling at that time in the company.
Yeah, they were never asked to be, you know, the main event talents on the show. They were at this point like on this show, it just was like it felt so weird and out of place to see this match because like the rest of it feels like kind of like it's heading in the direction where the show is now. We're expecting there to be actually like a legitimate women's match on the show too.
These were models who were trained to be wrestlers rather than, you know, as opposed to wrestlers who are now sometimes trained to be models.
Mm-hmm. And also they're put on TV. She was put on TV way too early and just forced to develop on TV. So like, and I think that's the problem with a lot of the WWE people is that you watch them develop sometimes. And then so by the time they're actually good, you're like kind of sick of seeing them.
Yeah.
Then they aired an ad for the very best of Monday Nitro DVD. And what did they use to emphasize the very best of Nitro but the finger poke of doom and Vince Russo wrestling in a hockey helmet? The best.
Yeah, the best.
Then we had Mark Henry and Big Show, which was set up with Henry putting Big Show through a table with the World's Strongest Slam the prior month. And the story is that after 15 years, Mark Henry has finally awoken. And this was quite the video for these two, this battle of the monsters. And Cole points out at the beginning of the match that Big Show's thighs are 36 inches compared to Mark Henry's 34. How's he going to deal with that?
Wow, that one
that
inch.
That thigh disadvantage.
Huh.
It's going to be the worst scissors lock he's ever been put in.
He rattled off this tale of the tape. And for all matches, like, this couldn't have used a graphic. Like this, the two big guys, like, we couldn't have done a fucking graphic. Instead, Cole just read out all these numbers. They fought by the announcer's desk, and Henry got sent into the steps. Show came back, attacking the knee of Henry, which had previously been injured, they stated, after Alberto Del Rio's car, which I guess he drove into. Henry then uses a half crab working the left knee. Show gets out. There's a shoulder block to Mark Henry off the second turnbuckle, landing on his knee, and then Henry catches him with the World's Strongest Slam, but Big Show kicks out. And Lawler says that someone dropped an ugly bomb on Mark Henry because he looked so angry. There was a second World's Strongest Slam, two splashes, and Mark Henry won in 6 minutes. And Cole noted that Mark Henry is on the roll of his career. I didn't mind this.
No.
I thought... Yeah.
What analysis.
I didn't dislike this at all. I thought they kept it short. They kept it exciting. And they told a simple story with Big Show's leg. And, you know, I felt like at this point... They display a lot of like veteran wisdom, and that I thought came in through Big Show selling and came through Henry's close up facial expressions and his body language. So I thought that these two excelled in those departments.
Yeah, like it's no watching Donovan Dijak versus Keith Lee or like things you're now seeing with some of these big guys that can do. But like for a WWE big man type match, this is like – this is great. And also, did you hear Mark Henry on MVP show this week?
Mm-mm. No.
That is a hilarious interview.
Oh, yeah. I've heard about
it. He's got some really good stories on there. And definitely I came out with a lot more respect. So it's funny watching this match, having listened to that interview.
Did you listen to Big Show's one on Jericho's show this week? I haven't heard it, but I've seen so many people recapping it that this sounds like a guy that doesn't give a fuck any longer.
Same with Mark Henry. Like Mark Henry definitely is telling some pretty gnarly stories about like the way he was treated.
They timed these appearances for our show.
Yeah, exactly. Like perfect segue so we can plug all these other podcasts.
Right WWE now. Posted up the SmackDown ladder match earlier this week.
Wow.
So, did they?
You know, they're ready.
When you've been there for like 20 something years, you know, you're ready to get out and you don't really have too much to worry about anymore.
These two guys like have been criminally underutilized since this time in 2011. Like this was right before Henry won the title, did the Cena stuff afterwards. It's like, dude, these guys have been ghosts in that company.
I think Mark Henry's done. He was saying on the show that he's kind of just like retired at this point.
Hmm.
And
not even traveled.
Close too.
Yeah.
But like imagine them in this era, how big they would look compared. Like at this point, these guys are all still giants. That they're, you know, booking like every single person on the roster, with the exception of Daniel Bryan and maybe like two other people, are like giants. Now, with some smaller people on the roster, someone like this would look like so monstrous. Like, that's why I think the big guys look way bigger now than they did at this point, even.
I think all of these big guys, after their WWE runs, should get into politics. I think that's the segue. Mark Henry and Silsby and Big Show. Where's Big Show even live?
Well, they're talking about having guns in Congress now in the United States. So I think you're going to need some like bouncer looking Congress people too to kind of even it out.
Have Big Show discuss the WMD, his safe version.
All right. And he's vaping the whole time.
Yeah, he'll like, be vaping.
He's like the vape lobby.
He's a big vape guy.
Really? Look up Big Show vape. On Google.
Well, I know I've seen him smoke cigarettes on a WCW show.
Yeah, what's your opinion on vapors? Do you have one? Are you one yourself?
No. Come on. Unless it's got cannabis and weed in it, then yeah, I will vape it. But like, as far as like just vaping like juice and stuff.
What is vaping exactly? It's not tobacco or is it?
There is nicotine in it.
Oh,
and it's like, it's kind of like a replacement people have. And it basically, you know, ultimately winds up looking like you got a smoke machine attached to the side of your head when you start exhaling these massive clouds. But like, yeah, it doesn't affect.
Vaping at the Hall of Fame.
There's one in the Hall of Fame, which is a shot across the row. And it's just him bent over going, it's like a nuclear cloud coming out of his mouth.
He's wearing a vape or die shirt in this one. Like,
he's the Damien Abraham of vaping.
Yeah, wow. He loves vapes. Man. He's like, and they're trying to make vaping illegal. If you talk to someone,
it's my favorite. Are you smoking the cigarette?
Yeah, he's upgraded.
He's like Sandman.
All right.
Cigarette smoking giant. Henry then puts Big Show's left ankle into a chair. Booker is pleading for Mark Henry not to do this as he comes off the turnbuckle with a Vader bomb to the chair. And Big Show just yells in agony. And the stretcher's brought out. They need a cart to drive him out. Not going so far as the forklift that they needed for Yokozuna, but the crowd goes into a CM Punk chant as though to say, fuck your ankle, keep the show going. And he's placed on the back of the cart, and Lawler says that this will come back to haunt Mark Henry.
The CM Punk chant was also in the first match, too. You could hear it throughout the whole show. Like, people just being like,
this crowd was here like, to see
one thing. The one-match show for this audience.
That was the thing. I mean, this audience was there. Like, this was a really great show, but they were definitely – they wanted to get to this main event.
Yeah.
Vince is with Laurinaitis backstage, and he calls this negotiation a nightmare. And young Josh Matthews walks in and asks if he has re-signed Punk, and he says no. He calls Punk the biggest ingrate he has ever dealt with, offered him the most lucrative contract and was turned down. And Punk fans shouldn't blame him because Punk told Vince to get out of the room. He puts all of the heat on John Cena for pushing this match to happen. And may God have mercy on John Cena's soul if CM Punk leaves with the title tonight. It's all Cena's fault. Then we had our second ladder match, the Raw version, with Alberto Del Rio, Kofi Kingston, Jack Swagger, Evan Bourne, R-Truth, Alex Riley, The Miz, and Rey Mysterio. I love these just collections.
And also, like, a lot of people that are now, you know, taking dates on the indies.
Who do you think vapes in this match?
Like weed or just vape?
Any vaping.
Evan Bourne, we know for sure.
Evan Bourne's only weed, though.
Yeah, but you got caught for oils. Yeah, for smuggling oils.
You take those in a variety of ways, but yeah, he definitely vapes THC oil, I think.
Yeah. Truth, Ray, and Evan, would those be your top three?
Truth, I think Truth is probably still like old school cigarettes, hacking butts. I can't see him, you know, maybe he's made the jump to the new tech. Maybe Big Show backstage was like, hey, try this.
That is not what that man sounds like.
I draw this. I was trying to, when he was doing that scream, it's like,
Rah! Yeah, he's also auditioning as Chunk for the Goonies sequel. Del Rio comes out in what is described as a $160,000 Lamborghini, and each guy brings a mini ladder into the ring for their entrances. And this is 1 month after they headlined a pay-per-view with John Cena versus R-Truth.
Oh, that was
a Capital Punishment.
That was at this time, right?
Yes. I loved his heel turn, Archer.
Yeah, me too.
That was such a, like, I thought it was, that's someone who was definitely not utilized to their full extent.
Mm-hmm.
This is also, they note, Rey's first Money in the Bank ladder match. Everyone attacks Del Rio with ladders and then dump them onto Del Rio on the floor. Cole explains that the smaller ladders are easier to hold and make for better weapons. It's the psychology behind these mini weapons. There's dives by Alex Riley and R-Truth to the floor onto Miz and Swagger, followed by Ray and Kingston. Bourne climbs the ladder on the floor and does a shooting star to everyone for this huge reaction.
It looks so good, like especially on the wide shot.
He's so good.
Yeah.
Like he's really good. And you know what? Weed. That's all I got to say.
Gotta be it.
What's your theory?
Performance-enhancing drug, John.
Gotta be it.
I talked to my friend Matt Riddle about it.
Oh, yeah? Does he believe it's a performance-enhancing drug? Because I always thought he would argue against that.
He believes that it's just like an essential vitamin. I don't know. I didn't ask him.
The Miz and Bourne then fight on the ladder, and Del Rio pulls out the ladder, and Miz crashes down, grabbing his knee, which referee Nunzio checks on, and the trainers help Miz to the back. So I kind of... Some people might criticize that this was too similar to Sin Cara's thing, but I think it for the payoff, it was actually better.
I agree.
The fact that they did this and kind of people believe – like Miz's selling was fucking awesome here.
Mm-hmm.
It was. And Miz is like someone that you had to see develop and only became like, you know, really good recently.
And this was after the title run where – I mean he went into a deep hole for a number of years. I would say right up until the Maurice return.
This was right after WrestleMania 27.
Yes.
Where he headlined with Cena but was overshadowed completely by The Rock.
This is when Alex Riley was just breaking off from him?
Yeah, off NXT.
What'd you guys think of Alex Riley? Because he got – when he broke away from The Miz, at least – when he feuded with The Miz, he got some incredible reactions. Mm-hmm. Like, I didn't always see a lot in the guy, but when he feuded with The Miz, like, there was something there, but
I think he came in at the wrong time, you know, as a babyface. He was not the mold that I think people's tastes were in. Now, we're talking about, you know, the pipe bomb promo right now and CM Punk being the face of the company. Alex Riley just kind of seemed really vanilla.
You know, he was also kind of labeled like, that NXT season, like that was the season that they were very high on Alex Riley, the one that Caval won, and almost they treated Caval like shit, almost in spite of this fan vote.
Yeah,
that Riley kind of had that. I think to some people it was viewed as, you know, the company's choice.
I think it takes a while for WWE to catch up with where the fans' actual tastes are at the time, and like they hadn't realized that it was all this sort of CM Punk, Daniel Bryan person. The same way now, I think, you know, like the people they have signed and the type of wrestlers they're featuring on 205 Live isn't exactly what the fans are looking for from their indie wrestling these days. But, you know, separate point.
All those nerds complaining. We continue here. Kofi did the springboard to leapfrog Swagger onto the ladder, and then Swagger applied the ankle lock to Kofi. Del Rio then missed Kofi and dove through the ladder to the floor. Ray did a 619 around a ladder to Kofi. Everyone climbs the ladders, and they're fighting for the case. Lawler calls it like Mount Rushmore. Bourne then tipped and fell to the floor, and we're down to Ray and Kofi. Ray gets knocked off and is left alone, but then Swagger returns. The fans cheer because he's going to stop Kofi, who they did not want to see grab this briefcase. Both fall off, and Swagger crashes hard, nearly dying here. Miz then limps back and everyone goes nuts for him. He's hopping up the ladder on one leg as Rey stops him. And there were actually boos here for Rey Mysterio.
There were a lot of
cutting off Miz. Yeah.
A lot of boos for Rey.
Everyone looked back to that rumble where Batista was in of Rey getting booed as the number 30th entrant. And it's like, wow, Rey got booed. But this match, man, did they not want to see Rey win this.
Yeah. And like, I'm trying to remember a time when there was this much resentment towards the babyface Rey Mysterio. Was it just because he was kind of dull and played out at this point? Like, it's hard for me to remember that time. But
or
here,
were these audience just pro Miz and pro Daniel Bryan at that Rumble that Rey represented the obstacle in front of them?
Were they that pro Miz though? I don't recall like when
they
Miz
were pretty
was
nuts
big.
When he made his return. I mean, that was a babyface return.
Yeah, I suppose. But I'm just thinking, like, especially coming off of that WrestleMania run where he was really kind of an afterthought. Did he, like, was he that much beloved as a babyface, especially compared to Rey Mysterio?
Well, I think but Rey Mysterio also at this point, they had taken all the excitement away. He was like the kid wrestler. They were pushing for the kids all the time and stuff. And so, yeah, like, you don't appreciate someone until they're gone. So I think people were just resenting him because he was around all the time. But it's incredible to think that this whole era of wrestling really is like, you know, Rey Mysterio and Psychosis kind of changing things way back when, and people seeing that, you know, and getting inspired by it on WCW and I guess maybe ECW before that.
Imagine how better that Rey Psychosis feud in ECW would have been if there was a woman involved and she left Psychosis for Rey. And then they had something to be an equivalent to FaceTime.
Maybe Lucha Underground.
Like, that would have made them so much more relatable, right?
That was actually to come, like with Torrey Wilson and Billy Kidman and all that.
The finish here saw Alberto Del Rio and Rey on the ladder, and Del Rio tore off the mask of Rey, shoved him off, but unfortunately Del Rio lost his balance, so he falls down too. And he just got the ladder back up, reset. And I was very impressed that he didn't panic or get the big pouty face that so many guys in that same position would. Mm-hmm. He treated it like it was real. Mm-hmm. Like they fell, raised down, he's distracted with the mask on, and he just climbed back up, grabbed it, and this didn't feel as though they tipped their hand like their finish got altered. They just ran with it, which I think so many guys can learn from. Like, when you're so regimented with a plan, treat this as though this was a real ladder struggle you had with a guy. And he just got back up, and I thought he handled it really well.
I'm also not sure what they could have done, you know, as an alternate finish to this. Rey had his mask off. Yeah. There's nothing else you could do.
Which really didn't go anywhere. Like this almost teased like some kind of hair mask program or something with Del Rio and Rey. Rey also got hurt after this, not too long after, like a month later, and was gone for a long time. But anyway, I thought an interesting finish, 15-52, and Cole puts over the fact that Del Rio won the Rumble this year and now Money in the Bank, and basically guarantees he is the next champion, where it was more just a hypothetical question regarding Daniel Bryan.
Del Rio, I think, is like one of the, you know, all-time great non-champion, like non-really gotten behind champions that WWE had. Like, he could have been – he's amazing. He's a main eventer anywhere he goes. Obviously, he has some interesting situations going on now in his life, which leads me to a question.
Yeah.
What non-wrestling product thing are you most excited for? The Netflix Glow series.
Yes.
Stringer Bell from The Wire's Discovery series where he learns to become a professional wrestler.
Didn't even know about that.
Or the what's the name movie the Stephen Merchant's doing? Oh, what's her name with Alberto Del Rio?
Page
or the Page movie?
For me, it's Glow.
The Glow?
Yeah,
I know it's gotten incredible reviews.
That Page movie, I'm really excited to see. I think it's gonna be a really interesting.
I know the quality of like the Netflix shows. Period. Yeah. And I just love the concept of it. So I'm really looking forward to that, which we may or may not review. Coming up.
We'll find out.
Oh.
But going back to this match, I love this match. I actually thought it was better than the other one, which I think is maybe unpopular opinion compared to most people's that I've heard. But I really like this one because of a lot of the creativity in it. Had kind of your usual dangerous stunts, but I thought the biggest reactions came not from any of those dangerous stunts, but from a lot of their creativity. I look towards that, like, you know, all the people, as simple as like just getting everybody up on a ladder up in that area, swatting, the briefcase around. I thought that provided a great visual. I love the finish of, you know, here's a guy, here's Rey Mysterio, and here's Alberto Del Rio fighting on top of a ladder. Well, I can knock this guy off, or I can simply pull his mask off and get him to panic and have him fall down and win that way. I really like that finish, so I like this Money in the Bank a lot.
Did you have a preference, one over the other?
I think I like this one because also what it set up. You know, like I think this one obviously is really great that Del Rio won it because that's like a believable person like that. You know, for watching this, I remember being like, okay, this is their out for the next match. This is how Alberto Del Rio is going to win.
Think about it too. Like the fact that a heel won this one, I'm sure maybe played a part in Babyface winning the other one, mm-hmm. and Daniel Bryan getting that position.
Right. Yeah, I guess I just look at how this all played out, that getting the title onto Del Rio, that took Punk off the title direction and sent him into that awful shit with Hunter and Kevin Nash for the fall mm-hmm. until they put the title back on him. And I thought that was so detrimental.
The texts.
But we're reviewing this show. I'm sure at some point we will get maybe later into 2011 where they had some interesting detours. Josh Matthews interviewed Del Rio in the back. He doesn't know why he was in the match because he was already the number one contender. This is a formality. His destiny will be the new champion, which turned out to be true a month later. Randy Orton and Christian with the unique stipulation that Orton can lose the title if he is disqualified.
Unique.
Yes.
Yeah.
That said, this was significantly better put together than the recent Ambrose-Miz debacle at Extreme Rules.
It took me a second to realize Christian was the heel here because this was coming off of Edge's retirement at the WrestleMania where he had a brief – Christian ended up having a brief babyface.
Very run. Brief.
But then lost the title to Orton.
Which I thought was way too soon. Like, they had something with Christian. I think that was his highest point as a single. And
that's why it felt so odd to see Christian as a heel this soon after that WrestleMania.
Like, Orton and Christian had an awesome feud. Like, they did this for several months, and they had some excellent matches. They would have another one at SummerSlam. But I thought Christian, as a babyface following Edge and all that emotion you had for Edge's retirement, they put the title on him. To me, it was like, you really had something with Christian. And I just felt they kind of watered it down with the heel turn. And ultimately, this Orton feud, I mean, it was all about Orton at the end of it. So Orton can lose the title by DQ. And part of the buildup to this included Christian taking Randy's wallet and dropping $1,000 on a roulette table, spray painting his bus, and making comments about his family that made Orton snap. Because Orton is angry, you see, and he's needed counseling for this. And Lawler concedes and notes that is a criminal activity that Christian perpetrated by stealing his wallet, I guess, and then gambling. Maybe he was trying to do the guy a favor. Like, if he had won, was he going to go and, hey, Randy, I doubled your savings in your wallet?
Randy's bus is brought up a lot in wrestling angles in the WWE.
So are his fictitious wives. Like, those fake where wives. He has a wife, but it's played by an actress.
Yeah.
Christian slides a chair to Orton right at the beginning and turns his back, hoping Randy will just idiotically take this chair and blast him. Christian got the early advantage. Crowd was hot for this. Orton clotheslines both of them to the floor, and then Christian hits a reverse cross off the turnbuckle into an Orton dropkick. Christian hit a kill switch, getting a great near fall that the audience did buy into. Christian then sets up for the spear of Edge, but then Orton leapfrogs and Christian runs into the corner post. Orton then attacks his neck. He sets up for the punt, which Christian avoids, takes a power slam, a draping DDT, and then Christian begs off and then spits in Randy's face. And Orton gets on top with these repeated strikes. He gets up, kicks Christian right in the balls, and the bell is called at 12 minutes and 19 seconds, and Christian is announced as the new winner and new champion. Before we get into the post-match attack, I'm sorry, but these matches, like, just makes Randy Orton look like a fucking idiot.
him, like, kicking Christian in the balls.
Right there in front of the referee.
Yeah.
It's like, oh, the anger was just, it just took you over. I just think these matches are so backwards when it's the babyface that can lose by DQ. I think it should be tailored towards you have this heel that's this chicken that gets out of all these situations, and now they're in a match where they can't get themselves disqualified.
Mm-hmm. But I get it here, though, because you're trying to sell the Randy Orton is so, he's so untamed that he can't control himself. I get that.
He's a viper.
He's a viper. He's actually very good at playing a human viper.
Yeah, he plays, you know? He plays like a, like that's like a person.
Slithery.
Like a person I would not like. You know, right. If you met him in a club, you'd be like, oh, this is the type of guy that would shit in your bag.
But I'm just more thinking about like his body language, you know what
oh,
I mean?
Oh, his walk to the yeah, ring, the way yeah. he sets up for the RKO, the way turns he his head, slithers, like he believes he is a snake.
He'll slither and then he'll strike,
yeah.
you know, like when the time comes. But I never like it when a title is changed off of like shenanigans like this. The way they were booking this, though, they ended up having a really long feud. So I guess this was just another kind of step in
there. Yeah, they had a big street fight the next month at SummerSlam. Like, I still liked the match. I'm not a fan of the stipulation. Afterwards, Orton attacks Christian on the announcer's desk and snaps. He attacks Christian with a monitor, and Booker just says, talk about anger management. Teddy Long is out to try and stop him, and it ends with Orton hitting an RKO onto the desk, but it doesn't break. Orton goes to leave, but returns to an enormous reaction, and he milks it for all it's worth as he yanks Christian back onto the desk, hits another RKO. The desk still doesn't break. And I mean, to their credit, the audience just got louder and louder for this. And they showed a close up of Orton as the crowd is chanting one more time. He turns, he eyes the ring, but then he leaves. And they showed a slow motion replay of the spit flying into his face by Christian, and Christian is helped to the back amidst boos from the crowd and grabs his title.
That poor table.
Well, I think that table did all right. I'm saying those poor
the
guys.
Poor people, I guess. You're right. I feel like more often than not, that spot doesn't work for a table break. You know? The Orton RKO. Unless it's on like a big opponent, I suppose.
Yeah, because it's almost like the guy delivering it kind of has to break it with the back bump, as opposed to the guy who's coming down forward and kind of is cushioned when he's going.
But like I guess it comes down to the amount of weight that's required to drive through that table, and it doesn't seem like that's usually enough. You know, the way they do it.
Yeah, Norton's got a new way of doing it now where he just carelessly throws someone over his shoulder trying to get it to the table. So
now he just clears
the
table.
He's figured out a different way to do it.
Yeah.
So then we had a Be a Star ad with Daniel Bryan, the Bellas, Alicia Fox, Booker T, Big Show, Kofi, and Eve Torres, which was their new alliance. Be a Star.
Alicia Fox has been around for that long.
Dude, Alicia Fox has been around a 10 long years? Time. I don't think quite 10. But 08 she was brought onto TV, I think.
Almost. Wow.
07, 08?
Who else is left from from this era? I guess Maryse.
Daniel Bryan.
But I guess for the women's division.
Oh, the women's division.
Know.
The
Bellas are kind of barely
on.
There.
Alicia Fox, who is still only 30, which is kind of crazy.
Wow.
Yeah, she debuted on the main roster June of 2008. So 9 years she's been on the main roster. That's crazy. And would have been signed before that.
Still has a job. She's doing something.
Yep.
Something
and she also, like, you know, holds her own in the division now, like, considering, like, these are, like, a different type of wrestler.
Yeah.
Like, she could argue she is the most storyline-driven character on 205 Live.
Yeah.
She's got the most going on. So after that, the place just explodes as the graphic for the main event is showing, and we go into a video package for the match, and it's bookended by Punk asking, do I have everybody's attention now? And lots of lost sound clips I noted throughout this video. Punk compared Cena to the Boston Red Sox no longer being underdogs, but they're a dynasty. And then compared Cena to the Yankees, and this caused Cena to snap. This was his spit in the face moment.
I love that.
He just snapped at this. Like, can you imagine being so emotional over being compared to a sports team?
I'm sure they howled at that in the back, you know, like the fact that
you're
this
the New
was,
York Yankees.
Yeah.
I buy this guy has like a different attire for sports teams in every city. Sports are very serious to John Cena.
this video was awesome. Like, this was really, really incredible.
The build leading into this, at least from the commentary and from the video packages, from the WWE side of things, were definitely seemingly positioning Punk as the heel. Mm-hmm. The threat to the integrity of the company, threatening to leave with the championship. And on the other hand, Cena was being positioned as the guy who is very noble in accepting the challenge, but he is actually he's the babyface. I would suppose like Vince is sort of like the other heel involved here as well. But I would say like promotional wise, it very much felt like Punk was, you know, the brainwashing cult leader.
As they brought that up continuously in the commentary, and even Cole, not even in heel mode, stating all these fans are cheering him, and then he's going to abandon them and leave.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like.
Bizarro world.
That's totally one perspective of it and not the other side of it where it's like there was a lot of dissatisfaction with the product at this time in 2011. Mm-hmm. And there was a very vocal audience that agreed with Punk. Whereas I'm sure internally there were a lot who saw a completely different view of it. That's what made this fascinating.
It was actually the WWE that were trying to do the brainwashing to convince you that people are cheering only for him because he's great. This guy's a great talker. You know what I mean?
Well, because you're like when you're the bad guy, you never know you're the bad guy. You think you're the good guy, and I think that that's the thing about this company is like they couldn't imagine a world where people would want to see someone leave with the title. Or would you want to hurt the company like that?
Exactly. Or even if they could, the perception they're trying to convince everybody is that that's not the case.
Exactly. And
it's politics. You know?
Well, it's even. I mean, it's kind of loosely attached to this, but even presently, there's like the idea of some of those in the company that. This is the big leagues. Why would you want to be anywhere else but here? And while maybe not the same level, like there are so many guys who it's like they're so much happier outside and there's more to the world than WWE.
Mm-hmm.
That you can have a perfectly happy career, satisfying one outside of the company. Even if the top end, you're not making that level, you can like I would without any knowledge of it, I would imagine – Cody Rhodes is making comparable money today as he was in his best WWE year.
Well, he gets all his merch, you know, and like this is an era where, you know, guys can sell merch at shows and people buy wrestling shirts in a big way and you can make a lot of money doing that and you keep all of it. You know, CM Punk would go on to become
– Hotels are covered primarily.
Hotels are covered, travels covered, you know, like they take care of you because you're like the main event on some of these shows. So they treat you well. Like
you're also creatively fulfilled and I think that for a lot of wrestlers, they'd give up, you know, money to have – be able to have great matches.
And the pay-per-view payoffs aren't what they were. I mean, that was a nice little perk if you were a pushed guy. And certainly for some guys, they still enjoy those payoffs. But for rank-and-file guys – I mean, they've seen that evaporate. This entrance to me is one of the more memorable ones, at least of this era, where the video ends and instead of just instantly hitting Punk's music, they let it sink in and the entire arena stood up. It was unbelievable. And I'm going to go back to this. Like this idea that we could have a guy in his hometown with this kind of moment and here we go out of our way to do the opposite is fucking astounding to me.
Yeah.
Like this was the fruits of your labor of creating a star in his hometown. Like could you imagine having this with the intent of beating him?
Well, they could have this most nights too. You could build a whole episode of Raw around one guy and their one woman's return to their hometown. And just build the whole episode and then have their big match that night. Like, and even if they lose that time, but like, you're right, they don't milk it enough. Even the loss isn't milked enough. Like, it's just like they beat him in the hometown and then it's just moved on from.
And to me, it's if you're weighing the two, like this idea of, oh, the heat it creates, I always find that a weird argument because you're not coming back to this city next week. That heat is fleeting. It's momentary. Mm-hmm. This hometown star is coming back, and that can be somebody that can at least lead your promotion. Punk was Punk in Chicago pre-2011 was not anything special, but after this, anytime they were in Chicago, that was a big deal with Punk. He was treated like a superstar.
To this day.
To this day.
Even the excuse of like them giving the heel heat for beating the hometown babyface. What did they do with Ziggler afterwards when he beat AJ recently in Georgia?
Yeah.
He lost to AJ the next week.
Is Alexa Bliss any more effective as a heel today had she won that title 3 weeks later on the next pay-per-view? Bayley, on the other hand, that was the beginning of the downward spiral that she has experienced at this moment and is now about to have a sexual relationship with Corey Graves. Like, that's where we're going.
Yeah. Here. It's weird.
I don't want to detour onto modern day stuff, but anyway. So the music then hits and this place just explodes. Punk comes out with probably one of the most profitable shirts that a man has ever worn in a professional wrestling environment. This was just custom made for the Chicago crowd.
This was the white with the Chicago flag. Yes. Yeah, the classic one.
Is this that? Would you say this or the GT? Probably this over the GTS shirt is like the bigger seller, right?
I feel like this one came right at this time. Yeah. So it feels GTS a bit more iconic.
This was the first big one.
Yeah. And then the GTS shirt's the next one they did, right?
This also, like, we didn't really mention, but like the whole pipe bomb thing kind of derailed his Nexus program when he was a leader of the
Nexus. And all his Nexus gear was gone here, although the key still listed him as Nexus.
Right.
But this was the end of his
It was the end of the Nexus.
It was the end of Nexus. Which it should have been.
The new Nexus with Husky Harris.
So he comes out in his shirt and everyone is chanting his name. It was kind of funny. They panned across the crowd and cut right to these boards with Pepsi logos as well, just coincidentally, which was kind of evened out because they were placed right next to Budweiser ads. So you had those.
Do you think Pepsi's ever reached out to him for like an attempt? And Punk would never do it, I assume. But do you think Pepsi's like thought about, you know, hey, how can we use this guy?
Maybe at some point. Like, but he's under contract with WWE for so long. And I think Pepsi, it's like, I don't know, it's like Katy Perry. It's kind of like a different type of star they go for. But like, you know. They get the advertising for free.
Yeah.
But maybe they did.
But
I haven't even played the video games, but is his Pepsi logo featured?
No.
No, it's not. And they obscure it on the toy, too.
Same with the Cobra logo. Yeah.
That's a serious, like, when you're getting a tattoo, it's like, if you're going to be on television, that's going to be a problem.
That's why all my tattoos are designed by me.
That's the way to go. So he comes out, and this place is just going nuts. He sits in the middle of the ring, just milks it, and they're awaiting Cena's entrance. And there, sitting in the front row, are Ace Steel and Colt Cabana, who, if you watch them here, they were awesome during this match. Like, they were so into it.
And Colt gets a chant, too.
Yeah. But if you're listening to commentary, they were CM Punk's fans.
His fans, yes.
And this is right around the time he started the podcast, right?
He started it a year before this.
A year before this, okay.
But, I mean, he benefited tremendously well from this.
Oh, yeah, because he had a
shout out on Raw. Yeah. And, you know, he was, I guess Punk didn't do any.
He did one episode with him. I think it was maybe his episode 50 or something. Remember, they had a big one and CM Punk was on there in the beginning of something, did an intro with him or something before the episode.
Perhaps, yeah. So everyone is awaiting, and then Cena comes out, and I thought this entrance was just as awesome as Punk's. Like, he comes out, it was none of the usual Cena entrancing. He just storms out. This entire arena hates this man. And, like, this was, to me, I guess you can trace it back to maybe the Rob Van Dam match at One Night Stand of Cena just being totally hated. But it is made for all of his big matches now have such incredible heat. That almost makes the match impossible to fail.
100%.
And that was the case here.
He's setting the template now for Roman Reigns, who is receiving very similar reactions. But I think at the time, you know, you look at it and it's easy to hate the guy. But now I watch these shows and like, I kind of admire how he's able to walk out there with the task of remaining babyface while you're in, you know, a territory that everybody's treating you like a heel. And he comes out with like, I think like really the perfect kind of physical, stature, you know, of a guy who's like, I'm hated, but I'm so confident that, you know, I'm going to treat this with curiosity, but I'm not going to lash out at this crowd.
Yeah. You
know? It's fascinating.
I don't know. I don't know how much of that negativity really exists. I think this guy's awesome. Like when you
not anymore, but like back at this time, I would say so. I think so. These people genuinely didn't like
at that time. I think today that's totally faded. Like his
That's why I think people have such high expectations now for those big matches.
There's no – I don't think people can get away with a you can't wrestle chant at John Cena anymore. You know what I mean?
Like, it's part of the show. It's part of
– But just, I feel like that would get shut down by the
like
rest of the crowd.
The five moves of doom thing is kind of like retreated. Like,
his U.S. title run I think has shown that – you know, and the number of great matches he's had I think has shown
if
that he
can
wrestle.
If you go back and really go through the catalog of matches this guy's put together, like it's pretty astounding.
Yeah, like I mean I even look at this match. You know, this was a five-star rated match by Dave, and it's not just CM Punk here. You can argue that Punk was the sloppier one in many cases.
Well, that's what I was going to say. Like, you know, like it's funny how this is a five-star rated match, but that's entirely because of the atmosphere. Because
yes,
the match in the ring – is not a five-star match, especially now that we've seen six stars plus.
But atmosphere is so big.
Yes.
It's big to me that it's if it didn't have that, there's no way you could go.
Conversely, if you had Okada Omega to a dead crowd, it probably wouldn't be six
and
a quarter.
Like at the job of the match is to create that. Like that is to me the thing I weigh maybe the most.
It's not like I think a great match is not just technical wrestling, but you know, all the build-up leading into it, the character, the promo played into, you know, the rating that this match received, I'm sure.
So Punk is standing on the floor in front of his fans and...
Sitting on the floor.
On the on the actual floor. He was just...
Oh, he was.
He's
okay. So sorry. I thought you meant the cross-legged.
When Cena entered the ring. And the best part of this is Cabana is just mouthing this promo at Cena. I don't know what he was saying, but he's just like yelling at Cena and like
Cole was definitely awesome. Playing his part, you know.
He was great.
Like, yeah.
He was just great here. So the match begins, just massive heat for the most simplest of things, like Cena reversing and applying a rear chin lock as they chanted "You can't wrestle." Punk then wants to clarify, he points at himself if they're sending those chants at him, and then points to Cena, and they all cheer when he points at them. Like it was like when you have a crowd like this. It's amazing.
Yeah.
Cole says Punk has the ability to brainwash people, and that is what he has done to Chicago, which has traditionally been a great WWE city. And they discuss how he could win and tell the fans he's leaving. And Cole compares this to the 97 Survivor Series. That bastard Brett wants to leave. They did early teases of both the AA and the GTS, which were blocked. Very simple stuff throughout the first 10 minutes, but got maximum reaction, I felt. Punk then goes after the neck of Cena with his knee drop off the turnbuckle as Cena is draped. Cena comes back. He injures his right knee upon landing, but then recovers and vertical suplexes Punk down to the floor. He builds up to the five-knuckle shuffle, and this was great, where Punk stops it by kicking him in the head.
Do you think that was like a legit, like, bad? Because that looked like just like the move didn't – he didn't land the move properly on Cena's knee, but then they turned it into a storyline. That's where I was like, oh, this is a
– It looked really – like, if he was selling, he did a great job.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it looked like an awkward landing when he comes off that for that cross – on he lands, like, right on his legs.
Well, he did need a reason to go onto the apron, though.
Yeah. And then that's how he does, I guess. But I thought that was, like, if it was on the fly, like, wow, what a great storyteller.
Yeah.
Cena then came back, went for the AA with Punk attempting to land on his feet and slips down, and then Cena blocks a GTS. Punk hit a pair of running knees and a bulldog and followed with the springboard clothesline, getting a two count, missed with a head kick, and then Cena applies the STF. Punk makes it to the rope and then head kicks Cena. Cena rolled through on a cross, on a high cross, lifting up Punk, who reversed it. He lifts Cena, and this crowd was just going nuts with the GTS teases. But then Cena counters into the STF, pulls him to the middle. Punk reverses it into the Anaconda Vice, which Michael Cole totally didn't know what it was.
Mm.
Like, just calling it a submission.
He's got him in his submission.
Cena then gets to his feet, hits the AA for a near fall, and then Cena hits a top rope leg drop. And this was also before there was the abundance of AA kickouts. Like, that really didn't become part of his big matches. I would say up until, like, the U.S. title stuff. Like, the AA was something pretty well protected.
Mm-hmm.
Cena then hits another AA, and Punk kicks out. Cena's just stunned here. He goes to the turnbuckle for a super AA, but Punk elbows him and hits a Frankensteiner off of the top. Punk then pulls down his knee pad, hits a flying knee in the corner, and a GTS sends Cena to the floor and hits Cena in the ribs,
that the announcers point out.
It was – the GCS, I would say, is always a little awkward on larger opponents, and this was the case here with Cena kind of being so much bigger than Punk. The GTS – thankfully, like, it didn't affect the finish, but this one only landing up towards the ribs.
Yeah, it wasn't. And they showed – like, they showed it from a different angle because it was off. This is when Vince and John Laurinaitis come out, and Punk is focused on them, gets caught in the STF, and Vince sends Laurinaitis to ring the bell and tell the timekeeper – but then Cena knocks him out and doesn't want to win like that.
Future father-in-law.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
Yeah, that's true.
And so Cena stops the win being handed to him, but then returns to the ring, and Punk takes advantage of his distraction and hits Cena with the GTS, and Punk pins Cena at 33 minutes and 44 seconds as Vince closes his eyes in disappointment, and Cole says that Punk's contract expires in 1 hour and 14 minutes.
Did you guys like the finish?
Yeah, like I remember at the time thinking it was amazing. Now looking back on it, I'm like, oh, you know, it's weird that John Cena still...
I actually totally forgot all the...
Yeah.
The run-in stuff at the end that led to the win.
It's still all about Cena at this point. And like you were saying, like, it's not like the company had shifted their philosophy to, like, CM Punk being the new face of the company, which is what I think at the time I was kind of hoping was happening.
Right.
And
it also... I mean, it probably happened too early doing the rematch at SummerSlam, but they were building to a rematch.
Mm-hmm.
Between the two, which, right. I mean, when you look at this, you could definitely make the argument that, I mean, it would have been perfect if you had SummerSlam in Chicago, but SummerSlam, this show would have probably done so much bigger, but you lose Chicago then, which is a huge part of this to me that is almost whatever business you lost on doing it on a B show. I mean, that atmosphere to me so helped Punk and made him feel so big that I don't know if you would have got anywhere close to this in LA.
Well, yeah, this show made him. Like, this show and this show did so much for wrestling.
Mm. It's all very reminiscent of One Night Stand 2006. Mm. I mean, with John Cena being in there. But, I mean, in that case, it was Rob Van Dam being in front of his essentially a home crowd. And the finishes were kind of similar where, you know... Van Dam was kind of winning that title through not very clean wins, and John Cena was still protected, and that was the case here as well. But with the blame being put on Vince for essentially costing his own company the belt.
And then afterwards, I had totally forgotten this spot at the end. Vince gets on the headset and tells him to cut the music and calls out Del Rio to cash in the Money in the Bank briefcase, which I thought was really clever. Mm-hmm. And Del Rio runs down and gets nailed with a Punk head kick. And it was like this great tease that, oh, they're going to fuck him. And then he thwarts it, which was awesome. It was like you got a secondary big pop out of it, and then Punk blows a kiss at Vince and runs through the crowd as the show ended. And
the kiss is awesome. It's like great. It's such an iconic, I think, photo now of him blowing that kiss and while he escapes through the crowd. It was just really like nice moment. You know,
so I feel that this overall angle is going to be remembered with how fast Punk came back to TV. All the stuff that would happen months after. But at this moment, after this show, like, this is one of the great WWE shows they ever presented, in my opinion. And I think people were certainly on a high coming out of this show because you had so many great options available, and Punk felt like the biggest star in the industry.
Yeah, like, there's like few moments that I can remember where there was so much hope on the law after a pay-per-view as this one. Maybe the day before, or the one before the TNA Raw started going up against each other, the night before that happened, where Jason was talking about getting two TV sets again. Again.
Yep.
You know, and the Nexus, during the Nexus program, just after the first week of the Nexus, like, you know, but I remember there being like so much hope. It's like, oh, CM Punk's going to come back with his faction, and it's going to be like all these ROH guys, and like then Samoa Joe's going to jump, and then, you know, little did we know where it would actually lead. And
but as you look at, I mean, if you look at this as a big trigger point to Punk being escalated to that level, like, Punk was very much a performer that catered to a different audience that I think was kind of slipping away from wrestling at that point. I think this grabbed a lot of people's attention. They were reinvigorated with this angle that the real benefits of this angle came years later, because I think it did open their eyes to an audience they weren't adequately satisfying, or at least that they could do more of. I think this, they probably looked at it as though this was such a tiny portion of the audience. And I think this, they realized there might be a lot more to this. And today you look at what they have done with NXT and the guys they're hiring, their television and their business is largely made up of this audience that will spend exorbitant amounts of money now. And I think Punk was a bit of an eye opener to them that they could make money off of this audience.
Oh, absolutely. This is the start of the NXT era. It's like the CM Punk thing and like them realizing that these guys, there is something to these guys and they can connect on a larger scale than just like in a VFW hall, you know? Mm-hmm. I think also the thing that I love about this show is that it makes it feel like, especially the CM Punk match. When I say this show, I mean the match at the end of the show. It makes it feel like it's a small room. Like it makes it feel like you're watching this in like an ROH venue, you know, like the field house, just the Chicago field house or something. Mm-hmm. 'Cause it feels that intimate when you're watching it.
Yes. And do you want to make mention of it?
Should we do it later?
I said we'd do it Monday anyway, so don't worry.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Never mind.
Anyway, you'll find out. As a show, what do you rate this, Damien? Is this 10.25?
No, like that's the thing is like, you know, it's a hard week to watch this show back. Like as a show, I'm going to say like maybe, like an 8.
8.
You know, like I would say that match for me is still like a 9. You know, but like this is the week where I did get to see, you know, what I think was like a perfect match. And this isn't that much of a perfect match. It's a perfect atmosphere.
I get you. For me, like it's different though, you know, because like I feel like I have more of a familiarity with the WWE product. And like it feels more like my home kind of like base type of atmosphere versus like a New Japan atmosphere. I'll give this like an 8.5. I thought the entire card was either, you know, I thought the two Money in the Bank matches were both really good. And everything else was there.
I thought there was only one really bad match on the show. And it was the women's
match.
The
women's match wasn't even that offensive. I'll say like those two did the best that they probably could at the time. And it was like, it wasn't that long. So like, it was an easy show to watch. And I actually quite enjoyed watching it and reliving kind of like the whole hysteria around that pipe bomb promo at the time. So that's my rating.
I go 9.1.
Wow. That's rare.
This is a really great show.
Over there?
Yeah.
You got a screwed rating system.
1/4 star.
All right. Do you, are we going to do feedback?
Okay, sure. Do you want to stick around for
Yeah, I'll stick around because we got to go eat food.
Yeah.
We start off with McWhalen. I enjoy the madness you two put yourselves through with all the bad pay-per-views, having reviewed WCW pay-per-views from 2000, Heroes of Wrestling, but I'm happy to see you finally put the microscope on Money in the Bank 2011. The opener was great with no one thinking Brian would win. The toilet break, my mistake, the Divas match, was as bad as they all were at the time. Sean Henry was as good as it could be as Henry was masterful with the Hall of Pain. The Raw ladder match was decent, but it had a few too many noticeable botches and everyone knew Del Rio was winning it. The world title match was good, not great. It was nice to see a DQ stip work for once with Christian using Orton's anger against him. The main event was a classic and was Punk's high point in wrestling and probably the best match Punk and Cena ever had. The crowd made this match and added that layer of a big fight feel that few matches have these days. Maybe the best Chicago show ever, and for many fans, this is the best non-WrestleMania pay-per-view WWE put on this decade. Would you say this is the best WWE pay-per-view of the decade, as some have said?
The current decade? Like 2010s?
Yeah.
Does that include NXT TakeOvers?
No. Not including NXT TakeOvers. So, okay, fine. Even including NXT TakeOvers.
God. You know what? I'd put that WrestleMania we went to in San Jose ahead of this. The one with...
Really?
Yeah. I thought that show was great.
Was that the Daniel Bryan one?
No. That was the Rollins cash-in one.
Okay. What's the Daniel Bryan one? Because that's also like an amazing show.
30.
But it's also like super long. And like it's really just...
Taker and Brock.
This
Taker
is up
Brock.
There though. I mean, you could argue definitely. This one. This is definitely...
Yeah I'd say I like, know. You know, it's, as you say, it, like it flows by so quickly. This show feels really short.
Yeah, I watched this in like two sittings and it went by very easy. Like there was big stuff throughout this entire thing. Like it totally had your attention.
I think I was let down by, I think I remember the Bryan Danielson, Daniel Bryan thing being like a much more definitive win and watching it back, it being, as you say, the inferior of the two ladder matches is probably why I'm not remembering this card.
To a lot of people, they thought that was a better match. So.
Yeah.
So, all right, we got Alex from Portland. When I first watched this pay-per-view, I thought it was one of the best that I had ever seen. Every match had delivered, and the main event was a marvel. Watching this show now is a treat, since the majority of wrestlers on the show aren't currently wrestling for WWE. It was great seeing, however, guys like Sin Cara, Rhodes, and Alex Riley were. While the main event told a hell of a story, the rest of the show had plenty of highlights. Daniel Bryan winning a fantastic Money in the Bank, Henry initiating his first victim into the Hall of Pain, the numerous botches in the Raw Money in the Bank, the crowd going nuts for Christian Orton. I find it hilarious that such a fantastic show came after one of the WWE's worst, Capital Punishment. My only complaint is that I had no idea who the IC, US, or Tag Team Champions were at this event.
Well, the IC champ, I believe, was Dolph Ziggler, who wasn't even booked on this show.
Hmm. Question. During this time, CM Punk was arguably the most popular wrestler in the company. However, considering his phenomenal showing, his historic 434-day title run was marred by the fact that he constantly did not main event shows. Cena headlined shows with him over him with matches against Kane, Big Show, and even John Laurinaitis. In hindsight, do you think that Punk not main eventing pay-per-views while he was champion was a good idea for the WWE?
I mean, as much as Punk was popular at this time, I mean, he still was the number two guy behind John Cena. I mean, you could argue which – I mean, it's not as though his programs weren't pushed. It was
– They were secondary.
They were secondary to Cena for a good amount of time. And then when the heel turn happened, I mean, that's when Punk did kind of ascend to that role. Mm-hmm. I mean, he was kind of – protected as the number one guy.
Do you think they were justified in positioning him as a secondary to John Cena's programs? Or should they have gone full on, you know, with him as the lead?
Well, it would have changed course of wrestling history, right? Because he probably would have stuck around if they had done that. That was his major complaint when he left, is that they never let him be the guy.
Well, they're not, like, reacting to, like, ratings, though. Like, aren't ratings – like, how did Punk's run do?
It's just because, like, they never gave John – they gave John Cena years to get to that position, right? Like, and it wasn't like, you know, you expect CM Punk to be
– The thing is, like, had Punk stuck around, he would have had his biggest years afterwards.
Yeah.
Like, he would have, I felt, got everything he had wanted at that time, especially with Cena taking more of a back seat in terms of his – week in, week out involvement that, and the style was changing significantly as well, that I think would have somewhat assisted him. I mean, he's also gotten hurt a lot that, you know, who knows how his body would have held up throughout 14, 15 and taking that time off. Like mentally, he was obviously burned out, but I feel that 2014 and 15, those would have been big years for him where a lot more would have been placed upon him. I mean, imagine him in this environment with the brand split. Mm-hmm. He would be the 1A guy on whichever brand he was a part of at the moment, I feel.
Yeah.
If he was healthy, and that's still an if, granted, if you tacked on another 3 years of a full-time schedule, which I don't know if he could have kept at that pace.
But like to position him as the lead over John Cena, it would require a company mindset shift to cater more towards that older demographic versus maybe the children. And is that the most lucrative option for the company?
I think he appealed to the children too, right?
Like did he?
I think he's the Han Solo. You know, like that's
the did your kids watch wrestling during the time?
No. My kids at that point were just born.
Right.
Only now is Holden. I'm really kind of like letting him get into wrestling and we're watching.
Does he know CM Punk?
He definitely knows CM Punk. We watch Punk versus Cena as one of his first
matches. Does he have a preference? Who is he cheering for?
I think probably John Cena. You're right. But I think that's because he's really young. But I think by the time you're like 10, you know, you'd want the cooler one.
Yeah, I'm curious.
You'd
I'm
want
curious
the Macho Man, not the Hulk.
There's always the argument that like advertisers will prefer the younger audience, yeah. Right?
And let's not downplay the business Cena was doing at this time. Mm-hmm. I mean, there was a reason he was in that position, and you can argue, oh, well, Punk wasn't pushed at the same level, but it's like, yeah, there's a point where if you're doing business that is showcasing you're above where you should be, then you would be. Like, Punk did strong business, did strong merchandise, but Cena was the number one guy.
But the company was never positioned around Punk in the same way it was positioned around John Cena.
But is that because of the preference of the demographic that each one represents?
Oh, I don't know. I think it'd be like you'd have to like position the company around CM Punk and see what that looked like. You know, and they obviously know, like, they've got billions of dollars riding on this, so I'm sure they're investing in the research. But I don't know. To me, I've always thought the most coveted advertising demo is that 18 to 35. And that to me is more of a CM Punk fan base than, you know, but WWE's positioned themselves much more like a younger company, like you said. So they want younger kids. And I guess that's like, that works well because you get the kids super young, then they get out of it. But then when they're older, they get back into it for nostalgia and you get them again.
Let's go to Christian. To me, the whole reason to watch this show was both the WWE and world title matches. I remember the Christian Orton feud so well, and I think the only downside to it was that Christian never really beat Orton for his title run. I agree with the above that it was nice to see the DQ stip finally pay off, but I think he deserved a bit more. You could have easily had him cheat to beat Orton in one of their matches, but despite that, I loved every match those two had together. They had perfect chemistry and created classics. It would have been the best match had it not been for Cena Punk. I've always been a huge Punk fan, and they were given everything to help make this match special. Being in Chicago, having that tease of Punk actually leaving with the belt, and Cena being completely hated by the fans. This is another example of how good Cena actually was back when fans were shitting on him. There's no way a match of this quality is created by someone carrying another. I've gushed over those two matches. I can't ignore the quality of the undercard on this show. Won't go over everything, but safe to say I truly enjoyed this show.
Sean from Manchester, England. Really good to see you go back and review a classic pay-per-view. A good Money in the Bank match to start with. Nice to see former Nexus Core partners team up before turning on each other. I believe this was Sin Cara's last appearance in the WWE. Was it?
He came back. He did come back.
Daniel Bryan was probably the right choice out of those involved. The Raw Money in the Bank is probably the second best ever, only behind the original from WrestleMania 21. Each guy played their role well. It was a nice touch that they all started with ladders, and it's incredible to notice how over Alex Riley was before the Cena backstage incident. Which was what?
The
Cena-Alex Riley incident?
I mean, Alex Riley has talked about some issue with Cena that he blames for his push being dissolved, but not going into specifics.
All right. He says, now onto the main event, the perfect storyline involving the perfect wrestlers at the perfect arena at the perfect time. Everything lined up perfectly. I've not watched the match in a number of years, but it still lives up to everything.
All right, next we go to Ronaldo. Perhaps the last match I really got into. Punk winning the title and being the Renegade Champion storyline could have gone on for months with him showing up at indie shows with the title, but instead WWE squashed the idea due to ratings worries. A great match nonetheless. I mean, the thing is, this angle would have played out much differently, I feel, today versus their pay-per-view era, where there's just no way that this guy, if you believe, was the top star in the industry, that they were going to do SummerSlam without him. Mm-hmm. It's just... like it just wasn't going to happen. He had to come back that quickly. Whereas today, a guy missing a pay-per-view, it's not going to affect your subscriptions at all. You could have told that story out over a longer period of time of his disappearance and eventual return.
I brought up the time you had me on for the very first time, but I always thought it would have been better if they had forced him to come back for SummerSlam. Like that was like Vince's like, okay, you have to come back. You have to do this, like, you know, it's contractually obligated, you rematch type thing. And then let him leave after that. Because, him not leaving did, I think, kind of take a wind out of it a little bit.
We go to MJ from NJ, who wants to ask if we can think of another time in the WWE since where a crowd gave a guy as big of a reaction as Punk received on this show.
In the WWE?
Mm-hmm. Like, has this been the biggest has there been a bigger reaction for a guy in a match since?
Daniel Bryan after the 14-second loss the next night on Raw.
It's pretty big.
Yeah, there's been a lot of big stuff. I mean, you also look at scope, too, like of Mania matches versus arena matches as well. Yeah,
the Brock return.
This was up there. Jesse from the Six. This was the only pay-per-view I've bought since 2002. I remember marking out during Punk's promo and my then-girlfriend having no idea what was so exciting about a man talking while sitting cross-legged. Even though I was watching at the time and listening to your reviews at the time, I still cannot quite figure out how this angle was so much better than nearly everything else the WWE has done in the past 15 years. The obvious answer is down to Punk himself and that they kind of just lucked out that his contract happened to expire right after a Chicago pay-per-view. But why did they give Punk the leeway to use forbidden terms like wrestler and John Laurinaitis? John once related a story, I think on an episode with Damien, funny enough, that then WWE writer Brian Mann told John that another writer in the room at the time of this angle said something to the effect of, man, this angle is so great. How are we going to fuck this up? And sure enough, 2 weeks after this, Punk was back, lifting his title against John Cena, lifting his new title in a bizarre pissing contest, and a month later, he was in a feud with Kevin Nash that would never be paid off and losing to Hunter. Oh well, this show was great, not just for Punk, but also for Mark Henry and Daniel Bryan. 4.25 stars, he says. And also, coming out of this, the next night was the big Vince deal, where he went to fire Cena, was interrupted by Hunter, who announced that Vince was being replaced, and ended in both crying in the ring in a very strange segment, and then starting off this title tournament that would be won by Cena to lead to this unification at SummerSlam.
Isn't that thing, I love you, Pop?
Yes.
Yeah.
That was the next night, and it was really weird.
I love you, Pop.
And Vince was not gone.
We go to Ahmad from New Jersey.
Oh, my goodness.
I remember the night Punk cut his promo. It was the day after my 23rd birthday. Several days later, John and Way asked me to make my first appearance on the Review and Impact series to discuss the speech. It was fresh, exciting, and believable. 6 years later,
we asked him or the promo?
I don't know. You have to ask. 6 years later, I think about the initial promo and subsequent main event. CM Punk still ranks as my favorite pro wrestling character. The energy and groundswell for him was only matched with Daniel Bryan, and certainly not since Bryan's run. 6 years later, I, like many, are left wondering, what if, as it relates to the handling of the storyline and the CM Punk character, I expect him back, just not in the WWE. Oh, and Bayonne, New Jersey is the armpit of the armpit of America.
We go to Mark here. One of the best pay-per-views in WWE history from top to bottom. It's such a shame looking back, and really at the time, for anybody watching, it was all about the squandered follow-up. WWE had buzz like nothing they'd had since the Attitude Era. I didn't even have a big issue with Punk returning to TV 2 weeks later. But a month later, you had Nash returning to attack Punk after he beat Cena at SummerSlam. Then Alberto Del Rio won the title. Then the setup for a match with Nash that ended up being scrapped when Nash couldn't pass the physical. Punk felt like the biggest thing in the company at Money in the Bank. He felt like a true star and one that had tons of mainstream crossover appeal. However, despite his eventual long reign starting at Survivor Series, they kept having him play second fiddle and never positioned him as the main event as he should have been. An amazing show top to bottom, but hard to watch and not directly associated with all the missed opportunities over the next 18 months.
DK from CT, what are your thoughts on the whole 5-star rating in general? 5-star match rating in general. Without taking anything away from Punk and Cena, it would be interesting to know if this match would get the same rating if it happened this Sunday, just 1 week removed from the classic, like Okada Omega. What do you think, Damien?
That's what I said earlier. Like, I don't know if it would get 5 stars now, but I think that's like, not that Dave Meltzer wasn't educated to Japanese wrestling at that point, because he was, but I think for the masses, like, people weren't. So I don't know. I'm sure there was, like, I don't know what was happening at the equivalent time in New Japan at this point, but I'm sure there were, like, matches that greatly exceeded this one.
See, I feel like if this match under these same circumstances still happened this week, it would still be an incredible event that could very well, you know, be rated that highly.
But it's also time and place as well. Like, that promo today, I don't think it's as impactful as it was at that time. It's like, it's all subjective, right? Like, I don't understand why people get so, like, it's like when people will get upset at me for being negative to a show, it's like, dude, if you enjoyed it, great. Mm-hmm. This is my opinion. Mm-hmm. Like, that rating is Dave's rating. That's what he thought. He's not consulting, like, this. He's not submitting this rating, and that's how the match is.
We're essentially asking, would Dave have enjoyed this match as much?
Why couldn't Dave have enjoyed this more? Yeah. Why did he enjoy this less? Like, who cares? If you thought it was a 18-star match, you have every right to think that. Well, like, it doesn't change your enjoyment of a match.
Because there's Dave Meltzer the person, and then there's Dave Meltzer the institution. And Dave Meltzer the institution is, like, a very key thing to wrestling, and, like, is a rock that should not be shaken, but, like, you know, he's a person too, right? Like,
but think of it this way, okay? Like, when the argument comes down to something like that's 4.5 for, like, imagine, Way, you did a test and you got 97%, and the next month you got 95%, and you're arguing about that. Do you understand how silly you sound?
Welcome to,
like, dude, you got 95%. Like, a 4.5-star match is fucking incredible. That's probably one of the best matches you'll see this year.
This is the pitchfork era of wrestling. Wow. This is exactly what music went through during the pitchfork hysteria.
Yeah.
About ratings and like.
Maybe we should have on our man Steve Juan to talk about rating rap albums.
Yeah, from rapreviews.com.
Who got angry feedback from some rappers about how he would review them.
Oh, my God. I'm sure. Like, you get, like, it's nuts to think, like, in wrestling, especially because there's no metrics. Like, with album sales, it's directly tied to how the album was reviewed on Pitchfork. Mm. But with, like, it's not like Dave Meltzer is like, people are going to go buy the show now or sign up for New Japan World.
Yeah, but it does affect guys like indie bookings.
Yeah,
you know,
true.
It affects, I'm sure, like, even New Japan World subscriptions and whatnot. So, like it or not, like, he is the barometer. He is setting the barometer. There are people that fucking place bets on what Meltzer might rate a match.
He's got moves named after him.
It's ridiculous. But the thing is, like, I was going to say, ratings, when you get to that upper echelon of, like, between a 4 and a 3/4 or 4.5, they're all good matches. But what it unfortunately does is you're slotting these matches now in an unofficial ranking system. Mm-hmm. And you're saying that, you know, this match is a 4.5-star match. It's not as good as the 4 and 7.5 stars match, you know, or this 6.25 star match is a better match than the 6-star match.
But so much of it is based on just your own feel. Like, at the end of a match, like, I can't give you a scientific breakdown of why I enjoyed this match so much more. I can outline key things that worked for me that Damien might hate about matches.
Do you think Dave rates like that, though, or does he rate based on, like, a public kind of consciousness? Because, like, I'm sure there are matches that Dave has seen that have meant more to him personally than, you know, than may have meant to the three of us. But would he still rate that match based on his own preference, or does he kind of get a feel of what the public feels?
Like, what did Dave give Ethan Page versus Darby Allin at WrestleMania weekend? Because hanging there watching it with my man John Pollock while my friend Wei Ting slept in the car – one of my favorite experiences of my wrestling life.
I was very tired.
Well, so that's because, like, you got bled on.
It's like a 5-star match for me, you know? Maybe,
but
it's an 8-star match.
It's kind of like, it's unfair pressure to put on any single reviewer to have to represent everybody. You know what I mean?
I don't think it should. I think it should be just your personal taste, whatever. Or, I don't know. I don't get into the emotion that could possibly go into a rating. Like, I could care less. It just, I don't know.
This is what fans do, though. We debate. We debate about reviews. We debate about people's opinions. You're wrong. I'm right. You know, it's just, it's all part of fandom.
Fan culture. Yeah. Like, that's what you want. He's like, you want, like, what is your top five matches of all time? It's bullshit. This is not there. How could this not be there?
Yeah.
All right. I'm starving. So this is our last one from Bax from Bangor, Maine. I was watching the Summer of Punk through a different lens in 2011. At the time, I was just getting back into watching wrestling. Me, my mom, and my little brother were taking a trip down to Africa to see some extended family. The internet at the place I was staying was fine, but we suffered from constant blackouts, so I'd have to rely on going to an internet cafe during the day. Never had I been more enthralled by a wrestling storyline than I was with this one. I remember reading the results the night after the pay-per-view and being shocked, a feeling that has rarely been replicated, especially by the current WWE product. I was a little disappointed at the aftermath on the Raw the next night, Cena not getting fired, the tournament for a secondhand WWE title, and Punk returning so soon after all he had said and done. But all in all, I'm glad this happened, and it played a huge part in why I'm a wrestling fan even still to this day.
Was Mauro Ranallo and Renee Paquette both still in Aftermath at this point?
Yes.
Well,
I don't know.
And Arda, right?
And Arda.
Yeah, Arda started the show.
That's crazy. Yeah, I remember Arda doing it for way longer. But
I think they were all there at the time. I'm not sure.
Three of those people wound up on WWE payroll at one point.
Yeah.
And for Jimmy Corderas, too.
Yeah, I mean, they've all had their time there.
Mm-hmm.
They've
That's incredible.
Done their tour of duty.
They're all very talented.
Is Narc the other guy on there? Who's the other person on there? They must be just
Narc,
waiting for
Nug.
Yeah, I'm just waiting for that WWE call now.
Nug would be awesome on like a Bring It to the Table or something like that.
The event center.
The event center.
Kathy Kelly.
With Nug?
Nug.
No, it's the other. It's the other. Who's the Sophia? Oh wait, no. What's her name?
Sophia.
No. Who's the Jackie?
Oh yeah,
Jackie.
Wow, this could be like that. But it's crazy. Aftermath, like that's like all of them. Pretty much.
That's the
welcome to your live event center. I am Wei Ting.
Can you imagine?
I'm just saying, like, this is going to be the next thing. Live audio wrestling is going
to
become the new
I think our path will be very different. Yeah. This is not the stepladder to any type of major platform.
Not at all. All right. Wei, what are we reviewing in 2 weeks on our next show, which will take place Friday, June the 30th?
We made a brief mention of it earlier in the review, but of course, the Glow series on Netflix is coming out probably, next Friday?
Next Friday. They will be releasing all 10 episodes on Netflix, I believe on all regions.
Yep. So we will review the show. We are definitely going to watch at least the first 5. And maybe if we really like it, we'll probably watch it all. But however many we can get through, we will talk about it.
And we're working on a guest.
Oh, maybe. Interesting.
So
maybe.
This is like Breaking Bad and Riverdale level for shows for you guys, right?
Breaking Bad or Riverdale? Nah, I like Breaking Bad. I don't know if it was my Riverdale, but yeah. I don't know what that means. Does he like Riverdale that much?
Yeah, you always talk about Riverdale.
I wouldn't say I'm obsessed with it, but I like the show.
There was a couple weeks where you were pretty obsessed with it. As a fan who was
I'm a fan of it. I like the show a lot.
Terrace House is my Riverdale.
Terrace House. That's it. That's what I was, way better thing. Terrace House.
So, but I'm looking forward to this Glow series.
Glow was the first thing I ever heard you guys review.
Oh, is that right?
On a review.
See, initially I was thinking, oh, we should review the Glow documentary leading into the Netflix thing. Then I Googled it and I was like, oh, I discovered that we had reviewed it. That's how I find out.
But didn't you review a Glow show?
Documentary.
Was it the documentary?
Yeah.
Okay. I don't think we've ever reviewed the episodes.
Okay. I thought you reviewed maybe an episode like way back when.
We might have done some women's wrestling.
Yeah.
That might or might not have been Glow.
Like this would have been like the second year of Review Away.
I don't
when
remember.
I jumped on.
It's been way too long.
Way too long.
Like I looked at this one. Like we had been doing Review of Raw for a year before this Money in the Bank event happened. Like mm-hmm. that's
if I like, a lot. If I had spent the time I spent listening to you guys learning a language, I could speak something probably fluently right now. Because I've listened to like hours.
Wouldn't have been as fun though.
Hours. I've taken you guys all around the world in my pocket. We're listening to you in the bathroom in Australia, listening to you in the bathroom.
Yeah, you've taken us
Austria.
To a lot of bathrooms.
A lot of bathrooms.
Oh man.
A lot of bathrooms.
We've been the soundtrack to many of your bathroom breaks.
Yes, definitely. Yeah.
Well, I badly need a bathroom break at this moment. What, Damien, is there anything you would like to mention for our listeners out there? I know you are a very busy man in the world.
No, shout out to the archivist because, do good work and,
yes, shout out to the archivist.
Hopefully see everyone in the fall when this wrestling thing comes out. But thanks, guys. I thank you for all the work you do because I listen to you a lot. And it's great I'm home now because I don't have to listen to this episode. And it's not going to throw off my toilet listening schedule.
Tell us about the wrestling show.
I'm doing this wrestling show.
Not the Vice one, but the podcast.
Oh, it's not really happening right now because of all my podcasts are kind of falling off a little bit. But I do.
Isn't so easy, is it?
It's not. Not when you have to do another job too. I don't know how you guys keep it up sometimes with all the podcasts.
But you mentioned the Jimmy Havoc interview you did.
Yeah.
Recently.
Oh, yeah. That's true. Actually, I did. I do Turned Out a Punk still had Jimmy Havoc on. You know, of course, the MVP epic. 2-part episode with one featuring Zach Blair from Rise Against.
Haven't you had a British trainer on from NXT?
I've had probably the coolest wrestler. That's the other thing is now that I know about Robbie Brookside, CM Punk doesn't seem so punk as he did when I first saw this show. Robbie Brookside's been on the show.
Maybe he'll get it.
I've asked you this before. Have you ever read The Wrestling by Simon Garfield?
No, but I want to read that book really badly. And also I want to come on here one time and review the wrestling documentary from the BBC.
Of course.
The Robbie Brookside documentary that Damien begs us to review.
I've been begging forever to review it.
Well, I promise over the next month, if I decide to take a week or two off, maybe you and Wei should review the BBC documentary. Well,
why would you take a week or two off?
Maybe I will. Maybe I want to hear this review.
Oh. Wow. Someone's got a big trip they're not telling you about.
Yeah.
Well, all of us need a break at times.
Speaking of which, where should we go for lunch?
I don't know, but that's all for us, folks. Taking us out is what, Damien?
Kulami by CCCP.
Okay, you can send me the link.
I'll send you the link. It's on Spotify.
Goodbye, everyone. We will chat with you next time.